feel the need for astute film criticism.
I didn't know about that. I reckon it's going to be scattered nonsense with...
i.e. Glenn Falkenstein for Falcon Screen. Captain Falcon.
Well, you can't be Captain Falcon because I was going to be Chris Captain Evans.
Right.
But
the only way to resolve this is with a volleyball game.
You're right.
Or with a dogfight. You could be Chris Captain Australia. Chris Evans, Captain Australia.
It's Captain Australia. Yeah, okay.
So this is Captain Falcon and Captain Australia on Film Fight Club.
By coincidence,
we are talking.
Both of our call signs are Captain.
Yeah, we're going to be fighting this out like Tom Cruise fights in every single movie because we are talking Tom Cruise, the one, the only, the enigma. It's weird for an actor so famous that he doesn't have much of a social media profile. He has such a persona and he's so well known, but he's not.
He has no media persona. There are a lot of jokes about, has Tom Cruise ever watched a movie? Because someone noticed the trend last year that in interviews, always without fail, when he's asked what his favorite movies are or movies he's liked, he says, oh, so many, and then launches into some vague, generic, bland response about all these great films. In reality, Tom Cruise is apparently a massive cinephile who makes sure to watch at least one film every day, but he just doesn't like to give anything of himself away in interviews. But we'll get into all this and more later. Virat is not here with us.
He is having a big week. He is moving. Congratulations to his new place, but he'll be joining us next week when he is nice and settled. Talk all things cinema.
Yeah.
I have heard that about Tom Cruise. It helps when you don't sleep so you can have that many hours in the day. I don't think he slept since like 1985.
I think that's part of his secret to looking so young, because when you sleep, that's when the time catches up with you.
But the reason we are speaking all things Tom Cruise is that, well, a number of reasons. Cannes was supposed to happen today. One of the premieres was supposed to be Maverick, the sequel, the long-awaited sequel. Not really long-awaited, but the long...
I mean, the long-rumored, now finally, becoming a thing right when nobody really wanted it. And Tom's also been in the news recently.
Because he is... My God, I love reporting this. This is so awesome. I can't even make this up. Tom Cruise is joining with NASA and the ISS. He is going to shoot a movie in space, being the first actor to do so. Of course, Tom Cruise is doing this. We've seen Oblivion. Oblivion was nothing compared to this. This is amazing.
Yeah. It makes sense for a guy who's made the latter part of his career about death-defying real stunts in the age of CGI, and how can you keep topping what you've done previously, keep doing things that have never been done before. But yeah, a big reason we're doing this is Virat's not here with us. We all kind of wanted a break after doing these long, expansive filmography, retrospective episodes, and we wanted to pick a nice chill subject where we've seen almost everything already.
Yeah, there's nothing more chill than Tom Cruise. So,
except on the couch on Oprah, perhaps a bit less than chill there.
It took us 3 minutes to get to the Oprah Tom Cruise reference. South Park covered this exceptionally well, as they covered Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise. But yes, Cannes is another big addition to the Tom Cruise going to space. Cannes was a big item in the news because it was supposed to happen today, but the festival have announced that they are going virtual to an extent. They're going to apparently be joining other festivals like Venice as a sidebar type event where you'll see elements of Cannes at these other major forums.
Yeah, it sounds like it's still kind of preliminary. The bigger announcement was, they realize now that they can't run the festival at all, but they insist on still having, to some extent, an official selection. Reading between the lines, it sounds like the official selection for this year's Cannes Festival that doesn't happen is just the films that have to have a release this year for some kind of financial incentive, like it's coded into the contract or something like that. And so they have to come to streaming or something, like they must be out in 2020. And of those films that were going to Cannes, they thought they'd give them the boost of giving them the prestige of the little Cannes logo on the poster and like, hey, we would have selected this movie. So we know that one of those films is The Five Bloods from Spike Lee, which is a Netflix film coming in June.
And speaking of the matter of streaming online, the other big news just overnight, we were recording this on Wednesday morning, is that Hamilton, the musical, it was supposed to get a theatrical release in 2021. However, to the great joy of musical theater fans, myself included, it's probably my favorite musical, is coming to Disney Plus on July 3rd, run in time for July 4th. Broadway will likely be closed, so we can all enjoy one of the three rumored, well-known, rumored performances of Hamilton that was recorded early back in the day with Lin-Manuel. So something very much to look forward to for musical theater fans out there.
Yeah,
you'll be watching Hamilton.
This was going to be released in theaters. It was announced a while back that Disney bought the theatrical rights to release the play of Hamilton as opposed to the film of Hamilton being screened in cinemas. But I think Disney, and now starving for content for Disney Plus, you know, right in the period where people start to have watched basically everything when it's a fresh new service and it's been out a few months, and they suddenly can't release it, a bunch of the stuff that would have been on the table because of this whole COVID-19 delay to productions. So it makes sense to take something that's fresh and ready to go and is this blockbuster draw when it'll be hard to come up with anything else. I think they're not ready to put their big summer blockbusters, but something like Hamilton that's, you know, pre-recorded, it was basically just a license to print money. The cost of making that wouldn't be big, you know, a recording of the theatrical performance.
Yeah, I'd prefer the theatrical performance to any filmed version. So this is a huge boon for Disney in that a lot of people who would never traditionally subscribe to Disney are going to say, either free trial, $8, yeah, I'm going to get that, and I'm going to watch Hamilton while I'm on lockdown. So on the matter of COVID-19, we are still social distancing. Chris and I are recording this from our respective abodes. We appreciate everyone who's out there flattening the curve so we can get back to movies, maybe even come to just after mid this year.
Well, you know,
reports may be indicating.
Yeah, that's something else that's been in movie news this week. Christopher Nolan is still holding steady to the idea that Tenet can be released around mid to late July, the typical Nolan weekend slot. He apparently wants to keep that spot because nothing else is coming out, and he wants to present the film as a gift of support to theaters. I think the idea is that since nothing else is coming out, Tenet can show for ages. So it doesn't matter if people don't come out in droves to see it opening weekend. And it just shows how much sway he has with Warner Brothers that they're even considering this when they've delayed all their other big movies. Apparently they need to make a call about this. It was reported this week. So I guess maybe by the time you're hearing this, it'll have been delayed, or maybe it really will be coming out in July.
Well, we hope we can see it very soon. It's certainly a major project. Everyone's going to turn up for a Nolan film. On Matter of Australia, certainly the speculation that cinemas could reopen come July with strict social distancing measures and with strict capacity limitations. But we are speculating based on the available announcements. We'll wait and see, and certainly we'll report on that in the coming weeks. In the meantime, things you can catch online. The Sydney Film Festival, in addition to being part of the We Are One Festival from May 29th and doing a virtual festival from the second week of June, are having a Q&A with Hugo Weaving, which is available for free on Friday night. Static Vision, the film collective, are running a live stream event with Trash Night and comedian Alexei Toliopoulos on Friday night as well. Tilda Melbourne, Melbourne's trans and gender diverse film festival, are running a pajama film party also on Friday night. A lot happening on Friday. The Tasmanian Breath of Fresh Air Film Festival, BOFA, are having the last of three weekends of streaming of films, of festival conversations. It's always free. You just have to sign up to their newsletter and you can access all the films. I've caught them both weekends past. It's been a fun time. The Sydney South African Film Festival is going virtual for the first time from May 16th and having an 11-day run screening. It's the second festival and the first time it's gone virtual, where they'll be screening a number of South African features, documentary shorts and narrative features. And the Smartphone Film Festival SF3, whose entries are open now, are having a smartphone filmmaking masterclass on May 18th. That's also virtual. It's all things you can check out in the coming week. But for now, other things you can check out. We caught all these films on Stan, Amazon Prime. If you're on Netflix, I know this is a double up of Mission Impossible among a few of the streaming services, but Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise has a special place in my life because Mission Impossible was the first big Hollywood action film I ever saw. So it's had a lasting impact. It's had an enduring impact for me. And Tom Cruise has had an enduring impact on Hollywood. He along with, by my reckoning, Brad Pitt, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Scarlett Johansson are the last really big modern movie stars who don't do television, who are just pure big lights cinema.
I wouldn't place, maybe it's just because of the sheen that being a huge star in the 90s had, but I wouldn't place Scarlett Johansson on that level. I don't think she's as much of a draw as those actors are for general audiences. I think she's brilliant. This is not a slight on Scarlett Johansson at all. I think she's finally getting her due. For a long time, people were falsely saying she wasn't a good actress, I think. But yeah, Tom Cruise was huge, you know, in the 90s, he and Brad Pitt, man. But Tom Cruise even more so, just growing up.
Well, he's the biggest of that group, I'd say. He's the biggest movie star.
For sure. And just as a kid, I just remember how larger than life he seemed and the media attention around him. It really shows how little people care about movie stars now compared to back then, you know. But yeah, Tom Cruise, man. It's funny. I've never really thought of him as a great actor, even though he's given some great performances. But I think he's a great movie star. He has this really unique charisma. He has this intensity where he can be vicious, which we rarely get to see that side of him in casting, but he can easily turn it that way, or he can be really cool and charming. But the charm comes so easy, and he has such a unique look. It's boyish but handsome. Like, he's so everyman. He can so easily get slot into any kind of performance, provided that the character is confident. I think Tom Cruise would really struggle to play a character that struggles completely with confidence.
I agree with everything you said. I think the addition to the charisma intensity, he just has so much cachet because, and it is more related to his career, he's just willing to go an extra mile and do things no one else, and certainly people of his era and age moreover, are willing to do. But I think with Cruise, he even in the early days, you look at even you saw hints of it in Risky Business, certainly Top Gun, which we're going to talk about in a minute, was the first great inkling of this. But he has more of a movie star presence than near any other modern performer. It's like on the level of James Cagney and a few of the early very, very greats. And it's to the extent that when he is in a movie, he's not just front and center. He's not just the lead, that he does not befit a role where he is not the center of attention. He does not befit a role where it isn't to some extent larger than life. There are exceptions like The Firm, which I really like, but the faults in his career is when he's gone to something extremely low key, and he's better, and he's more than, unlike most actors, just when he conversely does
the up. The way he looks and the way he presents, I think, means that we just don't buy it if he plays things too small. But I think we'll get to this when we discuss his later career choices. I feel like this tendency to always be the center of attention has turned into this massive ego eruption. If you look at his latter films, it's always about doing these incredible stunts as he gets older. And his character is always like perfect shining beacon. There's some exceptions. Mission Impossible has become like the everyone talks about how amazing Ethan is all the time kind of saga. And it's like, I wish you would do Collateral or Magnolia again. Just show us some of those other sides. Amazing. Yeah.
And on the 4th of July, some of his better performances. I think on Mission Impossible, we have talked about Mission Impossible in some detail in the past. We'll only be touching on it here in addition to Eyes Wide Shut and American Made, which we've also covered.
To be honest, but I feel Mission like we're just going to touch on a whole bunch of stuff.
We're going to be covering some in some detail, some in a little bit more detail. On the matter of Mission Impossible, it's fascinating to me that it is the coda for Cruise throughout his career. He did Mission Impossible when he was the young, plucky upstart. Mission Impossible 2 came along when he's making films where he is the largest he's ever been. He's invincible. He's magnificent. In Mission Impossible 3, suddenly, his life persona, he's a family man. He's settling down a little, but he's still doing what he does. And come Mission Impossible 4 and onwards, he's still doing it. He's showing that he can still be up there and at it. And he's showing that he can do stuff that no one else of his generation is willing to do. If you want one series and one role which can characterize Tom Cruise, it is Ethan Hunt. Moreover, because only one aside from Jack Reacher, he's returned to over the years.
Now, look, it only seems like he was a plucky upstart when he made Mission Impossible because his career has been so long. You know, that was 10 years after Top Gun. It was the same year as Jerry Maguire. He was already a huge movie star, you know. But in retrospect, it's like, oh, he's so young and fresh face. It's before the craziness of like the Eyes Wide Shut, Mission Impossible 2 years in terms of media hype around him, Vanilla Sky. But yeah, Risky Business, man. It's funny. That role is perfect for him because he has
20.
Yeah.
Just believe it or not.
He looks young, but that role has the kind of like smug edginess to it. And that's why for me, I struggle with Tom Cruise playing characters that are too nice in some of his latter films, because I think he does have that like kind of nasty edge in some of his performances. I mean, this is a good thing. You know, like he has that, like you sense that he has a dark side that he's concealing. And yes. for whatever reason, he started playing away from that. I referred to earlier, I feel like there's just a desire to be liked. But yeah, in Risky Business, you get to see the nice guy and also the hidden sides.
On that of Tom Cruise being nice guys, I think he got the balance wrong in probably my least favorite Tom Cruise film, War of the Worlds, where, yes, it's a larger-than-life scenario, but he's playing such an everyman who's so unaccustomed to what he's dealing with. Any number of other actors could have filled this role better. One of the roles where he does play a nice guy is, again, one of my very favorite Tom Cruise films, The Firm, and probably the best Grisham adaptation. But then the hard-edged element to his character comes in his role as a very competent legal advocate. So there's the right balance there. Risky Business, I liked it. I actually liked it more than Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which came a few years later, which it was emulating. But Tom Cruise, man, like the guy at 20 cannot, even at 20, he cannot pull off a teenager. He was young, and he looks young by how he looks now, but he just seems so much more
so beyond his years
and intense.
I was going to say in some ways that that's appropriate to the film, but no, he's also meant to be the innocent in that film very much in some ways. But you know, what was after the Risky Business? Cocktail. Have you seen that? I have not seen that.
The Cocktail was 1989. Top Gun, it was Legend, came about that
time. Oh, Legend, right.
And yeah, Risky Business, Losing Top Gun, Legend. And then Top Gun.
Let's talk about Top Gun. How can we not talk about Top Gun if we're talking about Tom Cruise?
How can we not?
Me and Glenn both watched this for the first time in ages yesterday. God damn.
I haven't seen it in 15 years. I remember I didn't like it very much on first watch. And it's been so, but it has such cultural saturation. It's been so endlessly parodied through Archer and Team America and everything. It's so self-serious.
It's ingrained in pop culture. It was such a huge hit at the time. The soundtrack propelled it. I think it's one of the early movies that people link to the idea of MTV aesthetics creeping into cinema. It's very, very tame by the standards of what that would become, but if you look at Michael Bay and you can see the seeds of his style in some of the
Tony Scott's early work. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, I think Bay kept on ripping Tony Scott forever. You know, Tony Scott went to the grainy switching film stocks, zoom, you know, wide, all over the place style, Michael Bay went to that. But yeah, the shots of the planes coming in at sunrise, you know, sunset, and this, the helicopters, it's just like, okay, I get where Bay got his ideas.
The action sequences are very well shot, to Scott's credit.
They are great.
This movie, it has the standard dumb 80s plot. You meet a guy who's going to have a family, you know what's going to happen to him. There's a bunch of action, machismo, a lot of charisma flying around, but it's elevated by a few things. The soundtrack, Kenny Loggins, Otis Redding, the Doobie Brothers, Take My Breath Away, great song. Obviously, Cruise and Kilmer at a very early point in their careers.
It's a great role for Cruise because he's an arrogant jerk, but he's also honorable. You know, it's like that those edges to Tom Cruise I was talking about, which is the place where he excels.
Yeah. On the matter of another character, so we never spoke about Val Kilmer on the show. On rewatch, I never realized this the first time. Iceman's the good guy. Like, he plays it by the book. He's being responsible. He's being prudent. And he comes in and says, I have a problem with the way this guy is acting. And it's not framed that way because it's an 80s action film. But Iceman, I've got your back, guy, dude. He knew what was on.
Yeah, I agree. Iceman was right. And Iceman was proven to be valid with some of the thing in his complaints with some of the things that happened over the course of the story. And Iceman is a guy with integrity. If Tom Cruise does the right thing, he's not just going to say, you know, well, that was just a fluke or whatever. He gives props, you know, nothing wrong with Iceman. But you know what?
Nah, he's a good guy.
Yeah. But you know what really stood out to me watching this movie now? Meg Ryan. You can just see the star she's about to become. She has such a small role, but she absolutely stole every scene she's in.
And did you say she had the best performance in this movie?
Yeah.
I really liked her. I liked her a lot. I mean, I think Val Kilmer was great. Tom Cruise, again, he was relying more on charisma here than we would soon see his very strong acting ability. The other performers, Michael Ironside, Tom Skerritt, are perfectly serviceable.
It's just such a stupid movie.
It's not a great movie.
I think it's just like the iconography of cool young guys flying around planes, like at sunset and like competing with each other. And he rides a motorcycle. It's just like kind of like a wish fulfillment fantasy. Like, I wish I was that cool.
It set the tone so much
for any
number of other films, but it's endured, I think, because and among so many 80s action films, it took itself seriously enough and didn't want to be schlocky.
It's not really an 80s action movie. Like, it is an action movie, sort of, but it's more of like an 80s... it's almost like a teen movie, except with young adults. You know, like, it's a melodrama. It mixes a lot of elements, which I guess is why people like it. I don't know.
a big issue with this movie is that there's no real character growth because nothing that happens has consequences, really. We see him do something stupid in the opening scenes, but no, you're still going to be Top Gun. We see a terrible thing happen, which granted wasn't his fault, but we don't see him actually learning from this.
I disagree. He does. He doesn't. He learns not to give up from that. But along the way, he learns maybe if, you know, like some spoilers here, he's told, you never abandon your wingman. And then even he... at the end, when he's being asked to do something else, he's like, no, I'm sticking with my wingman. So he does learn, be a little bit more by the book.
There's a very quick turnaround, Captain Australia.
I think he does become a little bit more by the book. But, we can't discuss Top Gun in 2020 without talking about the gay subtext people have seen in it. What do you think?
It's more than a subtext on rewatch.
I totally agree. I 100% agree. Oh, I was hoping you would say that.
So we played Cards Against Humanity this weekend, and one of the cards that's been in the original deck and always comes up is a homoerotic volleyball montage, which obviously harks back to Top Gun.
It's so...
not just the imagery. It's not just all the scenes in the locker room where there's just all these gorgeous men in towels hanging around. It's the line readings and so many references, which are very, very blatant. People make jokes about it, but no, it's very, very clearly there.
There's so many goddamn uses of, I'm going to put my butt on the line. And like, they keep talking about butts and
I want more butts.
It culminates in, I want some butts. And it's, like,
someone give me some butts.
Yeah, just, oh man, in the context of this film and everything else that's going on and some of the ways that Iceman and Maverick stare at each other, the volleyball scene is so strange to me because it's like, how did people not look at this and think it was the gayest thing ever? It's so much like standard commercial gay imagery, it's like softcore photo shoot quality in the way it's filmed.
The shot of Rick Vosovich, the guy who was in Roxanne and Terminator, as he shoots the volleyball, and just everything just slightly slowed down.
Yeah,
it's great, but it's very clear. Please, let's not kid ourselves.
It's not subtext. I agree. Top Gun is gay, and the thing is, you don't buy his relationship with the astrophysicist or whatever,
Kelly McGillis.
No.
It really annoys me. Kelly McGillis is in one of my all-time favorite films when we spoke about it a few weeks ago, Witness. She's so excellent in this. She doesn't get a lot to do here, even though she's the female lead, which is a major detraction for the movie.
But
and
she
you don't buy the relationship.
Not
he's,
at
he's,
all.
He's also the stuff Tom Cruise's character does, not cool. Not cool by any stretch.
With regard to...
The manner in which he pursues her early on.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. This story would not fly today. You couldn't play it this way. No. But yeah, just going back to Meg Ryan briefly, wasn't she so much more charismatic than Kelly McGillis?
She probably should have been in the lead.
Yeah. She seemed like
I could have seen it.
She actually seemed like she believed in her role and was investing heart and emotion into it.
And this was where people first really noticed her.
I think so.
I've always liked Meg Ryan.
Me too.
For all of like 6 minutes in the film and in every scene being opposite Tom Cruise or Goose, She has, and you needed her role to work in order to ground the emotional intensity of the most tragic elements of the film.
Yeah.
And she nailed it.
Yeah, yeah. She was destined for great things, clearly.
Lastly, about this film, I just want to note that in the opening text crawl, there's a spelling mistake. It says insure instead of ensure. And yes, Top Gun spelling and
the era before signs. The era before easy typo checks.
Well, that is Top Gun. Yeah, in case you're wondering what the scenes are like behind, what's behind, like behind the scenes at Film Fight Club, whenever Chris and I disagree, it always comes into an Iceman Maverick style intense show off. But
and then we play volleyball and sweat it all out.
We have not recently because of social distancing, which has been very frustrating for us.
I know. Yeah, just need to. Yeah,
but you can be my wingman anytime, Captain Australia.
Bullshit, Captain Falcon. You can be mine.
We'll find later on the volleyball court, Chris. And next up, we're talking. We're going to be talking much more on the podcast. We've got a few minutes left, but we want to touch on Tom Cruise's first great recognized dramatic performance, and that is the Best Picture winner from 1988, Rain Man, a film that was on Friday nights on Channel 10 every few weeks.
All the time, which is how I saw it. And you know, I haven't really seen it since. And given how much my taste has shifted, I'm not sure I feel really qualified to talk much about this film.
I haven't seen it. Granted, I haven't seen it in about 15 years, but I've watched it maybe 7 or 8 times. I liked it. It was my introduction to Dustin Hoffman.
Mine too. And it was also my introduction to the idea that Qantas planes don't fail.
Yes. This film is still played on Qantas because of that line. Where right. Qantas planes have a crash.
Really? That's great. Just reassure you on your trip.
Any film today which deals with the matter of autism in some way references or builds the template of Rain Man. There's a great film that came out last year, The Drummer and the Keeper, an Irish film, which had a similar issue, a young, plucky, good-looking guy in a relationship with an autistic young man, and there's huge shades of Rain Man in it. It's had also a huge impact on the cultural zeitgeist for talking about this issue and on films which have sought to deal with it going forward. So I don't think we can underestimate how influential it has been. I liked it. It showed what Tom Cruise can do. We're having an intense role, but subverting it to more dramatic ends rather than showmanship.
Born on the 4th of July, man. We're going to have to talk about that more on the podcast. It was big for Tom Cruise. It got him nominated. I think, I'm just double checking that. I think it was his first.
It was his first Oscar nomination, a first of two, I think. Oh, and just before we get into Born on the 4th of July, I just want to note Cocktail. It's not that great. Tom Cruise should not have played second fiddle to Brian Brown. And it's a film that has not aged well. I would say it's very much, unlike Top Gun, I don't think it's very much accessible and enjoyable beyond its 80s context. That's Cocktail, Born on the 4th of July. I first saw this years ago. My favorite Tom Cruise performance is Magnolia, but my favorite turn from him is this film because he was front and center. He was there throughout the whole time. He's excellent. We're going to be talking much more about Tom Cruise going on into the podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes and on Spotify. And
like us on social media.
And where can you find us on social media?
You can find us at twitter.com/filmfightclubau or at facebook.com/filmfightclub.
Please pick a fight with us anytime. Stay tuned for the Sonic Assassin.
Send us a suggestion, please, about a subject you'd like us to talk about. We're all ears at this point.
We're all ears, yep. And
we'll even talk
let us talk about events going on around town, too.
Please.
And we're going to be back next week with Virat Nehru. And stay tuned for the Sonic Assassin on 2FCR. This has been Captain Australia.
Captain Australia. Captain Falcon.
Captain Falcon.
There's two captains, man. No wonder this ship has such difficulty landing. Have a good night, guys.
Good night. Watch it in slow motion as you turn around and say, take my breath Welcome back to Film Fight Club, Born on the 4th of July. This tells the true story of a Vietnam War veteran and his experience during the war. And I guess this constitutes a minor spoiler, but we can't talk about the film without discussing this. He is paralyzed in the Tom Cruise plays is paralyzed in the course of his service in the Vietnam War. He comes back to America, and a lot of the film is about his experience climatizing back to a life in America, now a paraplegic, and it's being emblematic of how many Vietnam War veterans were treated and ill-treated in the years during and following the war.
It's not the first film to deal with the post-war experience for Vietnam veterans. Obviously, the major example a lot of people would think of is The Deer Hunter. But I think this But I think this film gave a really important perspective, you know, in showing the severity of some of the trauma and a really grounded view of what a soldier goes through physically and psychologically. I like the film. I don't love it. It has the same, to me, kind of like overblown, preachy quality to it that a lot of Oliver Stone's films do, I think. It's not as pronounced as it is in the stuff by him that annoys me the most, but I think it's a little too straightforward and prescriptive, but it is moving at the best moments in the narrative. It's based on the memoir of Ron Kovic, real life guy who went through this experience. I can totally understand why Oliver Stone was drawn to making this film about him and with him, because they collaborated on the screenplay together. Kovic is a guy who went from being, you know, super pro-war to coming out, being changed by his experience and becoming a peace advocate. Oliver Stone is a guy who went through Vietnam and came out as a guy who makes anti-war films. There's a synergy there.
I actually prefer this in many respects to Platoon, a film which I don't mind films that, yes, they're dramatic recreations of war, but they play out as action scenes. This has less emphasis on the action, more emphasis on the psychological impact. I like that more. In regards to Tom Cruise, this was pretty much ideal casting for him, because we see the opening sequences where he's getting recruited, and it's very strong shades of Maverick, and he brings that intensity of, I'm Tom Cruise, I can go out and save the world. And then when he finds out that's not possible, we see him turn to the more dramatic scales of what he can do as an actor. And there's great sequences he shares with Defoe, including one later in the film in the desert where there's a confrontation between two main characters. There's a great one where a confrontation with his mother and his family in the house.
Oh yeah, it's a great scene.
The final sequence in the film is superb.
I think
it's one of my favorite Cruise performances.
Yeah, Cruise's intensity really works here for the moments when he flies off the handle or just expressing his anguish. You believe it. Cruise can sell you on that intensity of emotion. And he also has that kind of innocence in his look and, simple kind of played straight emotional intensity early on to contrast, so that, you know, when you give him a beard and shaggy hair, it has a big visual impact. See also The Last Samurai.
Yes. Don't see The Last Samurai.
But
We'll talk about it later. I had the unusual experience of going to this film not knowing anything about it, or about the author. So when the major event happened at the end of the first act,
you were genuinely surprised, right?
I was surprised. I was shocked. It was a major about turn, as was seeing Tom Cruise transform into the shaggy, more seriously focused figure. It's a great subversion of the more hyper masculine elements which Tom Cruise would still continue to propel in the later stages of his career. I'd recommend it. It's a film that has gone at least outside of the States, a bit outside of the cultural zeitgeist. People don't talk about this when they talk about Tom Cruise. Chris, your reference earlier to how he's never considered a great actor. He is a great actor.
Well, you know,
people talk about Mission Impossible, which he's good in, but not nearly on the level of.
Yeah, he's great. Well, it's funny you say that, because I was talking to my mom and she said, you know, she asked what we were doing on the show this week, and I said Tom Cruise, and she mentioned Born on the 4th of July, and I said I hadn't seen it, and she said, "What? You know, how can you cover this if you haven't seen Born on the 4th of July? He's so good in it." So I then had to go and watch it for this episode. But yeah, it shows that at least for some, it left a big impression, and they talk about it when they think of Tom Cruise.
It's a film that I know my dad, that doesn't watch a lot of movies, but I know it's a film he was very fond of. Vietnam does have a particular place. The Vietnam conflict does have a particular place in my family. I was talking to my roommate about Tom Cruise, and I asked her just casually, hey, what do you think of Tom Cruise? And she said, she paused for a second and said, my mom likes Tom Cruise. And I know that he does, intergenerationally, he is seen very differently. I think you're right. We don't see him as, at least our generation doesn't see him as the major movie star, at least in the level he is.
It's partly...
I mean, 90s. We saw Top Gun contemporaneously.
It's partly his own fault. He needs to stop doing exclusively action films.
He hasn't done a dramatic film. Collateral was his last real...
Probably.
Dramatic film?
Collateral is an action film, but it's a dramatic role. But since then, he's been just action hero roles.
And Lions for Lambs was not good. So we can't really put it in Top
Gun. Lions for Lambs was, what, 2006? So almost like
2007.
2007, okay. That's a fair while ago. Valkyrie was the same year, right?
Valkyrie was 09. I'm just bringing it up now. Valkyrie was 08. Yeah, that's a while. Also an action film with dramatic, overriding dramatic elements, but also a bad movie.
Yeah. But yeah, over a decade of entirely hero roles, it's not good for his public reputation. I think he can do better. I understand wanting to be at the
full. Real low point in that regard.
Yeah. I understand The Mummy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll get to talk about that later.
Yeah. I understand the desire to be front and center in an era when dramatic films aren't holding the place in multiplexes that they used to have. But, you know, we'll get to that. It's such wasted potential. You know, this is an Academy Award nominated actor who's given several brilliant performances. And now it's all about like the I do my own stunts thing.
I'm impressed that he does, but you know, more.
Yeah, I don't want to take away from that.
What I'd like to see him do is return to fantasy. I really like Interview with the Vampire. I haven't seen Legend. I understand it's good. Why doesn't he try stuff? And I'm not talking science fiction. He's good at science fiction. He does a very action-oriented science fiction. Edge of Tomorrow, Oblivion, which in fairness, both very, very good films. Do some fantasy.
Edge of Tomorrow more so, I think. But Oblivion is cool from a visual perspective, especially.
Well, as terms of his next films, to my discredit, I have not seen the two early Nicole Kidman co-starring
Far and Away. Man, Days of Thunder was on TV the other day. I missed a small chunk of it because I had to take a phone call. But man, Days of Thunder, it's another Bruckheimer Simpson production directed by Tony Scott.
For anyone who's seen Talladega Nights, this is the film they're taking the piss out of.
Right. Yeah, I see that. It's basically, you know, reuniting that Top Gun team. It's basically Top Gun, except with cars. it's the same kind of dumb, predictable story, you know, where like there's an accident and you've got to recover from that. You've got to find your feet again and the confidence to get back in that car and win. You know, it's the same story, but it's so stupid. The aesthetic that music video... TV commercial, glossy Jerry Bruckheimer, Tony Scott aesthetic has really evolved since Top Gun. Watching this, there's just such style in a lot of the shots. It's worth watching in that regard, and to see young Nicole Kidman, sure, but also mind-blowing is the bit part from a really young John C. Reilly.
Right.
Yeah, one of the guys in the pit crew. But the pit crew of Tom Cruise's character, who I have to name because there's no way we can not discuss this name if we're talking about Days of Thunder.
Cole Trickle.
Cole friggin' Trickle, man. Doesn't it just send a cold trickle down your spine? Oh, God.
In terms of bad movie names, it's down there.
Days of Thunder, I was actually more entertained and got more of a reaction out of reading the description of the production debacle on Wikipedia than I did out of watching the movie. It's basically describing a whole lot of dueling egos in the production, mostly from the producers, but also from Robert Towne, who wrote the script, resulting in this calamitous mess of a production. So much so that, spoilers, he does cross the finish line of the final race. They forgot to get the big shot where he crosses the finish line during the production. So in the actual film, they have to use an editing trick of just another shot of cars driving and put the voiceover saying it's the end of the race.
It reminds me of the Silver Line.
They forgot to film the car crossing the finish line at the end of the big race. Like that level of chaos on set. Oh my God. Anyway.
It reminds me of at the end of Silver Linings Playbook when there's that huge dramatic moment when there's competition, everyone holds up the numbers, and it's the big crux of the film, except one person on set, Jackie Weaver, pointed out the numbers didn't add up, so they couldn't actually show the shot on the film. And in an otherwise well-directed flick, it's really, really awkward, and it's damn very noticeable. David Ross, what were you doing? But Days of Thunder, is it, I mean, should I see it?
Look, to give you an idea about how dumb it is, early on to Robert Duvall, his, you know, the mentor, manager guy,
Bob Duvall's in this, God.
Yeah, I know, right? So much money and talent on just junk. To give you a sense of how junky, he admits to Robert Duvall that, oh, I actually don't know anything about cars. He's this amazing racer. And so in order to become better, he needs to be taught about cars. But it's so transparently, how can we work out a way to explain all this car terminology to the audience? Like, you expect me to believe that a person gets to that position without just getting interested enough in cars because he drives them for a living, that he cares about the performance aspects of his job and his craft. You're just not supposed to think about anything. The romance is dumb. You know, Nicole Kidman plays the, like, a hotshot doctor who he falls for. I don't know. Should you watch it?
Batman Forever.
Yeah. Look, should you watch it? I mean, if it
sounds like no.
If the above, like, it's not terrible if it's like on in the background eating Cheezos.
I mean, Cheezos, Chris.
Well,
no, sorry, I'm from Australia. All right,
let's move on. Break.
What does strike me about this era of his career is that this is when he and Nicole Kidman, remember they were married, it was a long time ago, were seen as king queen of Hollywood.
Well, this is the first film they did together, apparently. Yep. Tom Cruise saw Nicole Kidman in Dead Calm and asked for her to be
great movie.
Days of Thunder. Yeah, that's how it all started. Yeah. We didn't see Far and Away, which is one of those
Far and Away.
Those next films they did together.
On the matter of Tom Cruise's persona, there was a time in the 90s in Australia where people loved Tom Cruise because he was married to Al Nicole and she was the biggest movie star we had at the time, and possibly still. She's fantastic. And then I remember when they divorced, there was this whole period of, we hate Tom Cruise. So his cultural cachet in Australia shifted very dramatically and very quickly for quite some time. Everyone's well beyond that now, but you couldn't talk about Tom Cruise in the 90s in Australia without talking about him.
What he did to Al Nick. Yeah,
she's still on it. We love her. A Few Good Men. Actually, what's next? A Few Good Men is next.
A Few Good Men.
Based on the Aaron Sorkin play?
Yes.
And first big breakout hit his career.
And I believe it's his first screenplay. And, you know,
it's the first Aaron Sorkin screenplay. It's based on his play, which has now been revived at Broadway very popularly. It's a very well-received production, the latest one. I actually prefer the play. It's better in confined settings. It's a better drama when it's more easy and more seamless to cycle between all the characters. Here, there's all these travel sequences which don't serve much function.
Except maybe for expanding it and removing that feeling that, oh, this is just a play, right?
I don't mind it being just a play. I think it works in the context of a relatively insular drama.
Right.
It's a courtroom drama.
I was going to say that for a first-time screenwriter, whether this is because of Rob Reiner, the director's input, or just that Aaron Sorkin just had the knack, it doesn't feel like, oh, I'm just watching a play that's been filmed. Like a lot of scripts by playwrights adapting their films, or a lot of adaptations of plays end up feeling.
It doesn't feel it at all. You know, to see my all-time favorite television show is The West Wing, and you'll see a lot of early hints as to what The West Wing would become in terms of the fast-talking dialogue, relationships in the
characters. So sharp, man.
A character called Danny.
The dialogue's
really
so good.
Strong, fast-paced.
Really clear character arcs and moments of transformation and stuff. Like as far as classical script writing goes, it's perfect.
And a good approach to exposition and layering it within the script and what else is going on. It works in the context of a procedural courtroom drama.
Yeah, absolutely. I like this movie, but I don't have much passion for it. It's a pretty standard courtroom drama that I think is elevated by the military aspect.
Yeah, I've seen this maybe, again, this was another one like Rain Man and Jerry Maguire, which we'll talk about in a minute, that was on TV every few Friday nights on Channel 10. I've seen it maybe a dozen times.
Yeah, it was on all the time.
It also brought Guantanamo Bay into the zeitgeist long before the controversies more publicly ensued surrounding it. It is partly set there.
Yeah.
So the beginning of the film is set there. I like Jack Nicholson in this. I like Demi Moore in this a lot. I rewatched Margin Call, which I really like. She's really underrated as a dramatic performer.
She is, for sure.
And however, and we're talking about Tom Cruise. We have to talk about Tom Cruise. He's the weakest in this of all the other actors.
You think so?
All the others have more interesting characters and more stuff to do. Daniel Caffey, the Cruise character, is pretty much a mouthpiece for Sorkin, and his earnestness, again, when you have to emphasize earnestness over intensity, Tom Cruise doesn't fare well.
But he gets to have
very much of the character is here.
Early on, he gets to play a smug jerk, and it's only over the course of it, the film, that the earnestness wins out. But he still gets to have a great rant moment along the way when he does his "You're stupid" rant to Demi Moore.
And he gets to do his charming Tom Cruise shtick too. What is it? I've been asked some of dates before, and this is what it sounds like. And it just comes, it could come across as arrogant because Tom Cruise comes across as so natural and it works in the scene.
His character is arrogant though. You know, his character is an arrogant guy who sort of, it's almost like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington kind of.
Oh yeah. I don't like boats. This is what a courtroom looks like.
Yeah.
Scene with the baseball where he's in the pit and just swinging and just trying to get a deal.
But yeah, it's totally the story of like the jerk who learns about honor and integrity and becomes a nice guy. The way that it ends, by the way, with a big classical "the end" sign, like this is a 40s film, I think is a great touch. It's like they knew that they were ending on a Frank Capra type note, so it's like, here it is.
It hadn't actually occurred to me, but yeah, it's a really similar. I do like the classicism of this. It's a really similar arc to Maverick. But it's better handled here because the interactions with Dawson and I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name of the other person who was charged with the murder.
Good memory to remember Dawson. Dawson's the one who speaks anyway.
He's the one who, and actually this film has changed. I watched it after becoming a solicitor once and I remember watching scenes of it being frustrated with how the two accused would interact with him. But in the context of having interacted more and more with clients, I can see, this is actually in many respects, depending on the person you're engaging with, relatively faithful as to how legal counsel can engage with
interesting
the persons they're forced to advocate for.
Sorkin, someone who always likes to do his research.
Very well. Yes, and he went on for this to The American President, a film I don't like as much, but he could have made The West Wing without it, so I'm all for it. I think it's good. I think it holds up too. And it's not just the "I want the truth" scene, which everyone talks about.
And always quotes. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot to quote in this movie.
But it really, it just shows that Jack Nicholson is the star attraction of this one, right? You know, people just love the delivery from Nicholson.
Oh, Nicholson, how's your father, Danny? He died 7 years ago. Don't I feel like an asshole?
Yeah.
He's bloody good. If you can, man, the next film, another legal thriller, is The Firm.
I haven't seen this one in a long time.
Again, Friday nights.
It was on 10. Often, yeah.
Yeah.
Much nicer lawyer than in A Few Good Men, I would say, overall. Like, not by the end of A Few Good Men, but like, less kind of like this guy's a dick vibes going on.
Oh yeah, we like him. I mean, he's a bit of a Mitch McD. He's a bit of a bland do-gooder, but more than If You Could Admit, more than most legal thrillers, that's actually how the law operates. It's relatively faithful, but Grisham, like Sorkin, did his research, so it pans out. I actually like this a lot. The Pelican Brief is my favorite Grisham adaptation. The Client would be next, The Time to Kill, but The Firm is a close second to The Pelican Brief. And Cruise, again, there's just the cast that are working wonders around him. Ed Harris, David Strathairn, Gary Busey, Gene Hackman. There's a really strong supporting element to this.
Mm.
All working pretty much top of the game. I liked it. I don't have too much to say about it. I think it's a competent thriller where we could see Cruise doing dramatic work, but the intense comes through in the sequences where he has to do legal work or where otherwise he is confronted with the extreme circumstances. So a great balance for showing the scale of what he is capable. Yep. And then Interview with the Vampire. Again, I prefer the book based on the Anne Rice novel. Very controversial casting where he was Lestat.
Yeah.
People are happy about this, but it panned out.
It's not faithful to the book, but as I understand it. But
I've got it behind me on my bookshelf, actually.
Nice. But yeah, I dug his intensity. It's one of those things where he has the charisma, he has the sharpness and the physicality. But yeah, I haven't seen it in ages.
Yeah, 20 years. So
yeah.
More for me, actually. Also, Christian Slater, Banderas, Brad Pitt.
Solid yeah, cast. Amazing, amazing cast of people who would go on to become too big to be in a film together unless it's one of it's like a Soderbergh movie or like Mother's Day or New Year's Eve or whatever.
You know, Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise not being in any films together anytime soon. I mean, he did DiCaprio, but that took Tarantino to do effectively second last film.
Yeah, 96, huge year for Tom Cruise with the two different sides of him, Mission Impossible and Jerry Maguire.
Can we just touch briefly on Jerry Maguire? Again, Channel 10 overplayed.
You know, you were talking before saying like that Born on the 4th of July dropped out of the zeitgeist, but I think it's interesting how much Jerry Maguire has dropped out of the zeitgeist, because I remember growing up, this movie was everywhere. Like you would always at video stores see the poster up even years after it came out. I remember seeing that logo everywhere. The quotes, "You show me the money and you had me at hello and help me help you." And like this movie,
they're still used.
They're still
separate
used.
To their context.
Yeah. This movie was so saturated into pop culture, but today no one talks about it. Is it just that it was just way overexposed relative to how good it is?
I think it's that it was overexposed, but I think it's two other things. I think Renee Zellweger, she's still great, but she doesn't have the cachet she did 25 years ago. But more than that, Cameron Crowe, man, he has, I like Almost Famous, but he has fallen.
Most of his movies,
favorite in Hollywood, so
most of his movies in the early part of his career are good. I agree with, you know, that, he's fallen out of favor. Maybe cinephiles don't want to talk about Jerry Maguire, but this is a mainstream mass market movie. The fact that like, I guess maybe this is just getting old, but for how exposed this was, like there are other like 90s films that have way more of a cultural hold still. I saw on TV again for the other day, Clueless, right? Also from 96, or, you know, the first Mission Impossible, though that is a franchise. Interview with the Vampire has lasted longer.
More of a cult following, I'd say.
Yeah, but that seems to be a film that still exists more than Jerry Maguire.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? It's just strange.
I know exactly what you mean. I think it's this. Jerry Maguire was the first really big blockbuster to deal with scandal in the sports world. It's a relatively honest film. I appreciate it for that. But then 3 years later, a better template and a more serious blistering template came along for this, a much better film, Any Given Sunday. From then, there have been any number of films, Concussion, others, which have dealt with issues of how athletes are treated. But the template and what has remained strong is the type of Any Given Sunday. It's not just that we've seen these narratives played over and over. It's that Jerry Maguire falls a bit out of favor because it's not as intense or honest as we come to expect of this genre now. So I think that's why it's kind of moved away from what people expect or want in the sphere.
Yeah, it's a strange movie now. That seems very 90s. For the record, I like this movie. You could say it's not so honest. It's a manipulative crowd pleaser or whatever. But in the better work by Cameron Crowe, there's a genuine sweetness that comes across, like he really loves his characters. It's not just about, oh, what will the audience like seeing. You can tell that he is a crowd pleasing kind of guy, and he's invested in these characters in this story. There's things about it that don't hold up so well today, like the way it treats the divorced women's club kind of as like objective derision, but you know that would not fly.
but there is something wholesome to the, no, no, this relationship can still work.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's such an, this story, it's a good story, right? It's a good story that you don't typically see in romance films or romance comedy films.
Yeah. Having said that,
and it has really interesting characters. The Cuba Gooding Jr.'s character and his dynamic with Tom Cruise, really interesting.
He won an Oscar for this.
Yeah, like this movie actually has a lot going for it. Like when you look at how debased our cultural landscape is today.
Get back on the camel. It's like, I don't want to be on the camel. You don't want to be on the camel? Yeah. Okay, don't be on the camel. That's not parody now. That just happens.
Yeah, exactly. When you look at, yeah, it's like, why can't we have more movies like this? Like a big crowd-pleasing blockbuster movie about characters with wholesome or not so wholesome messages, but just make it about the character. I'm fine with wholesome, by the way. Just like, I would love a wholesome movie about the power of love and trying to be a good person like Jerry Maguire to be a blockbuster these days instead of some ironic wink fest about action figures and Happy Meals.
We're talking about Marvel.
But if it's not Marvel, it's going to be any number of their imitators or some other thing like that, you know? Like, think about how huge Jerry Maguire was, man.
But look, anyway. And I say this, and I agree, and I like it, but by pure virtue of it having aged a fair bit and being so oversaturated in my childhood, I don't think I'm ever going to watch it again. Like, I've seen it a lot.
Yeah, I've seen it a lot as well.
And you know what? It was the film that my family were, like, a lot of Friday Night Films family, like, this isn't necessarily appropriate. Jerry Maguire, yeah, that's all right. Let's all watch it together. So
it's got that family film vibe, you know? And yeah, even though it's an adult movie. One more thing that, you know, the thing that I've thought most about with regard to Jerry Maguire in recent years, talking about how overexposed it was. A few years back, there was a exhibit in LA. The Everything is Terrible, I think, is the name of the group. They had a series of weird video editing montages of esoteric VHS ephemera, basically. Those guys put together an exhibition which is like a video store, which is entirely VHS tapes of Jerry Maguire, because there were so many of them in circulation that one day they got this idea when they'd just been going to thrift shops and seeing Jerry Maguire tapes everywhere. They were like, let's just start collecting them.
Just Tom Cruise's grin with his crow's feet.
Yeah, exactly.
Everywhere.
And it's funny because I mentioned Jerry Maguire VHS and you can see it in your mind's eye, right?
Yep. It's him looking down. He's half side on. He's not looking at the camera and he's grinning.
He's grinning.
And it's lit from the back.
That video was everywhere. It was like it was the video that would always be at Coles and Woolworths and Franklin's. You know, like it was. It was.
Yeah, it's one of the most oversaturated movies of this era.
Yeah. I guess that's it.
Honestly, can you think of a film that was played more on evening television than Jerry Maguire?
Men I would Black, say maybe? Now Love Actually has to be getting up there.
Yeah. I wonder Love Actually is cyclical. Jerry Maguire just played all the time.
But the thing about Love Actually is kind of cyclical in that it plays at Christmas, but they also play it just whenever. And I remember it playing one year, like every couple of weeks, a couple of months. Wasn't this on 2 months ago? And it wasn't just December to February. It was just randomly in the middle of the year on 2 months apart on the same channel. So hopefully Love Actually will have its Jerry Maguire moment where people just don't want to think about its existence anymore.
Look, I like Love Actually. I don't think it's aged well in some respects.
I kind of like Love Actually too. Not as much as Jerry Maguire, is not okay. Probably, but you know, they're both nice, enjoyable. Jerry Maguire is much better. But Love Actually, you know, it'll do.
Just a last point on Jerry Maguire. One of my favorite Tom Cruise line readings is when he's on the plane and he's describing his proposal to another passenger, where he's talking about how his wife was in the lobby and he couldn't bring up the courage to propose because she knew it was coming and all the footballers were crying. It's really nice.
Yeah, again, yeah, yeah. And it charms Renee Zellweger. But he...
Was it to Renee Zellweger?
No. She overhears it on the plane and gets charmed.
That's right, yes. So it's been a while.
But yeah, he brings that everyman thing as well as the intensity to this role. You know, he ramps up the charm. But it's very, very Tom Cruise. he has such a distinct style and such distinct mannerisms, right?
Yeah. People try to... I don't think there's ever been a really good... Ben Stiller's was funny. There's ever actually been a really on-point Tom Cruise imitation. I mean, I try. Help me. Help you. But there's no one who matches that level of intensity, charisma, gorgeous looks, movie star presence.
He's so full on every time.
Yeah. It's hard for him to share. What film in the modern era... has he, I mean, we have to remember Val Kilmer was a bigger, was about the same level of Tom Cruise level of fame in Top Gun. But when has he actually shared the screen with a young, up and coming, brash movie star like him? Never. He's always front and center. I mean, he was opposite John Voight in Mission Impossible. John Voight was great. When has he really come up? A Russell Crowe in The Mommy?
Hey, Russell Crowe is well established at that point. Yeah. Right, Russell Crowe was already a movie star. Like, past his part. Russell Crowe would not have taken that mummy role 10 years previously because it would have been below him.
No, but he's it's very rare you'll see him on screen with actor of Crowe's.
It's true. Yeah.
Yeah. We should pop back to Mission Impossible.
It all comes back to the ego. It's maybe the ego that like not wanting to be, I mean, I can't say this about Tom Cruise personally. I don't know the guy. But
if you're out there, we'd love to meet up with you, dude.
Yeah. Maybe not after what I'm saying at the moment. It just, there's the, it falls in line with the trend of always playing characters in movies he produces that everybody loves and that don't have many flaws. You know, like not wanting to be upstaged, having to be the center of attention. But maybe it is, as you say, also a choice by directors because they know that is the quality of Tom Cruise. We shouldn't try to make him anything but the center of attention unless it's just with a romantic interest. That's about as much as we're willing to dial it down.
You know, he's playing Tom Cruise to some extent in every movie. We talked about how he doesn't have much of a public persona, but what is relatively well known about him is that it's not just that he's a hard worker, it's that he takes a much more active role than most performers and in a producer function in leading the narrative of his films. We saw this later in the Mission Impossible series where he kept bringing on Christopher Macquarie because Christopher Macquarie brought the type of drama and characterization of Ethan Hunt that Cruise wanted. But because of his star power, he can sell, you put Tom Cruise at the top of the poster, you're guaranteed a couple $100 million. So he has enormous influence. But and he exercises it in every one of his projects. And it shows.
I guess we can discuss this later, but it's amazing how he was not destroyed by the Scientology era. You know, I know the Scientology era continues, but when Scientology became the main thing people think about when they hear Tom Cruise, the Oprah jumping on the couch incident around MI3's release, I would say it was that point.
Yeah, that was when... It was the first time that people were always, there was inklings of his private life in the press, aside from his first divorce, but this is when there started to really be a bit of a backlash against Cruise. People started to not like him.
Yeah.
He was on top of Oprah, and again, with Mission Impossible 3, it showed him being a nice guy, always there for family, and each of the Mission Impossible films have done this. Each of his tentpole flagship movies have come out to say, I'm still there for everyone. I'm still the Jerry Maguire's good guy, you know.
But back in the year that Jerry Maguire came out, he was a bit more of an edgy Ethan Hunt who sometimes seemed a little bit dangerous and intense in the first Mission Impossible.
Yeah. Speaking of, 96, this was, I don't think he knew at the time that it would be an action franchise. I don't think anyone did.
I think they maybe hoped
it
would.
It's not a franchise, it's an anthology. Now it's serialized.
I imagine they hoped it could become a series because it's just like the James Bond type thing, you know, like the spy goes on continuing adventures. But, you know, you only cross your fingers whenever you take on any big endeavor like that. Mission Impossible works really well. And it holds up better than all the others because it's less of an action movie.
It's a classic spy thriller. And De Palma's dialogue and the staging, it's so noir. It's so heavily stylized.
I think the script is by Robert Towne and David Coepp, though it wouldn't surprise me if De Palma did some writing on the side, as he's known to do. The dialogue and also the staging, but the staging even more than the dialogue is so noir. And it's so, I love the larger than life style of De Palma. You know, like the canted angles in this movie are going into overdrive.
Like the restaurant.
The restaurant scene I was thinking of. Fantastic. And like
that restaurant scene, it's so, okay. In any other hands of a director, it could have been just the standard filler scene. And in the hands of a director, that dialogue would have come across as stilted and ridiculous.
But he matched it with the visual so well. It's standout sequence.
I've been to that. I've been to Prague. I've never seen that square that empty. But hey, it's a movie, so
yeah.
Or the bridge.
True, but yeah, I have as well. But movie magic. I like Mission Impossible, the first one. Moving on.
We want to talk about the other Mission Impossibles and else. It has a special place in my movie watching. I really like it. I like that the twist didn't come. They didn't treat the twists as massive surprises, given they were pretty straightforward. It has still one of the best high sequences at Langley. The train chase at the end, it's phenomenal.
It is silly, though, the escalation to that level of stunt. They wanted a big finish, but it's a shame that that became the main thing that the Mission Impossible series became about. I think it would have been better if they'd stuck to a balance like this, where there maybe was one or two big bombastic action scenes, but keep the focus on the spy thriller aspect. But it's just become something else now.
Yep. As it's again moved from a anthology, here's this director coming in to put their own spin on it, to here's the
Chris McQuarrie. Here's this director that I like.
Who gives me the vehicle I want.
Yeah.
As opposed to I want a different, least stylized film.
Yeah.
So having said that, they're great. Like my ranking is one. I've revised it since we last started Mission Impossible. It goes 1, 6, 5, 4, 2, 3.
So there was a long gap in Tom Cruise's career while he spent over a year shooting Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah, Eyes Wide Shut, the infamous long extensive takes that Kubrick would have Cruise do, dozens per shot.
Yeah.
It's a very good movie, which we have talked about extensively on a 1999 episode. Flashbacks?
It's a great film. I think one of Kubrick's best. But what's interesting about the use of Tom Cruise is that Tom and Nicole aren't here for the glamorous power couple, which is how they typically have been used before, in appearances together during their years as a big Hollywood power couple. Here, I think Kubrick is using them for the intimacy that they bring, and also perhaps as an inversion of the audience's expectations about them, because this is a film that's really digging into characters' sore spots and feelings of inadequacy in a relationship, especially Tom Cruise's. And it's almost perverse casting a real life couple in these roles.
Yeah. I really like Cruise's casting in this. It's the first one, even more so than The Firm, which shows him as a young, handsome, flashy, successful, extremely confident person, again, reflective of his real life persona. But at this point, it's not saying this guy's 22 anymore. It's showing there's a maturity to his screen presence. Kubrick understands this.
Yeah.
And we, moreover, when we see it unravel when he's in the gift shop, sorry, the costume shop, when the great scene with the call girl, which is my favorite scene in the film, beyond the crazy sequence in the mansion later, we see Tom Cruise come up against real challenges to even his breadth of confidence.
Yes.
Or his characters, I should say.
His character shows the typical Cruise confidence, but the way that Kubrick harnesses the intensity that we keep talking about for Cruise is interesting, because here the intensity mostly comes out as a way of projecting his feelings of inadequacy. You know, it really comes out as a way of expressing his anxieties in a subdued Kubrick style way. But that's where I think are the loud points of the performance in Eyes Wide Shut. You know, his moments of fear and doubt.
It does so well to contrast it with, at the beginning of the film, his character is confronted with an extreme situation which would make most people feel panic or threatened. I'm referring to the potential imminent death of a young woman in his friend's party. And he just handles it, I mean, so calmly and so across. But then we see him confronted with different but still confronting circumstances later, and we just see his character slowly start to consume him.
Yeah.
So it's a contrast which Kubrick knew so well to set up. And the dream surreal-like elements, which shows Cruise being so nonplussed, the great bit where he returns to the costume shop in the middle of the day.
Man, yeah.
What do I do? Oh, everything's okay now. But when we last saw you, no. Everything's all right.
Yeah.
And with any actor, you would see your own misgivings reflected. But with Cruise, it's just so much more pronounced because it's underlined by him being so cool otherwise. And everything's done. Kubrick is doing well. He's obviously seen every Tom Cruise film, and he knows how to play out his persona.
Yeah. The next big run for 1999, a really interesting year for Tom Cruise roles, with him matching up with auteur directors. Magnolia.
Frank T.A.
Yeah, he plays Frank T.J. Mackey, a name I will never forget. A guy who basically gives self-help talks for incels. Would you say that's an accurate description?
I'd say that is an extremely accurate description. Can you? And actually, it's a nice little world. Imagine if Tom Cruise had never become an actor, but wanted a career where he could use and utilize his intensity. He could have been a self-help trainer or a motivational speaker, and he would have been really successful.
It's perfect casting by PTA. PTA always shows that he understands movie stars better than maybe they understand themselves. Better than, at the least, casting directors and directors have. I think he has a talent for seeing the underlying qualities. And when it comes to Tom Cruise, you know, how can you contextualize this larger than life intensity? Where do you see that in life outside of films?
No, you've seen it a few times, just moving away to his public persona. Some of the times he's blown up a little in public. The infamous Peter Overton interview, the stunt where someone squirted water in his face on the red carpet. We had Adele Drover on the show a few times, a film critic for Roll Credits, and she interviewed Tom Cruise on the red carpet of The Mummy, and she was telling me about it. And there's a bit where he's just chatting to her, and he's talking about his experience with The Mummy, and then he just stops, stares directly into her eyes, and says, "I want to thrill you." And he was just like, what do I do now? What do I say? I'm frozen in space and time.
She was thrilled.
Well, not by The Mummy, but I think he's on the movies.
Yeah. But in that moment, he succeeded.
Can you imagine Tom Cruise like staring into your face like so, like, just, and it's like, "I want to thrill you." Like,
I can't imagine it.
10 minutes later, I'd still be frozen.
Yeah. I can't imagine it because of all the Tom Cruise watches I've been doing. But
it has been a fun rewatch.
Yeah, yeah.
He makes fun mostly just movies you can consume easily.
So, speaking of rewatches and Magnolia, you haven't seen that basically since it came out, right?
No, I haven't seen it since release.
Did you really see it when it was released? Like, did you see that in cinemas? Because that would have been one of those like bad parenting choices, but it's like, I'll forgive it.
I just saw a lot of films as a kid. Look, they know I liked the movies, and they just said, "You go, have a fun day." And they knew at the local cinema, they didn't really care. It wasn't an ultra-violent movie, so...
So seriously, you saw Magnolia at the cinema?
Yeah.
Dude. Anyway,
yeah.
We won't discuss Glenn's age on the show. Suffice to say that...
I was too young to see this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was too young from a... Yeah, from the view of the classifications board and general morality.
Yeah, but anyway.
Yeah, it was either that or American Pie, and I just didn't want to see American Pie.
Right. Well, you made the right choice, son. Actually, today...
That was the point of my life where I was just too cool for film school. And so American Pie, nah. And I've since mellowed, and I do like that series.
Well,
so.
I'll drop a bombshell now and say that if you ask me now whether I wanted to watch American Pie or Magnolia, I would always pick American Pie, and not just because Magnolia is 3 hours. Magnolia, I enjoyed as a teenager, but watching it again a few years back, I was shocked at how indulgent, messy, overblown, just goddamn loud it is, and 3 hours of it. By halfway through, it's like, oh my God, too much, too much. Just rein it back in. Like, does every single story always have to be at the highest moment of intensity all the time? Maybe that could have worked in a movie half this long. Maybe. But yeah, Tom Cruise's bits are a highlight because at least the histrionics well contextualized, and because he commands the screen. Anyway, I've soured on Magnolia.
I can't offer too much astute criticism because I haven't watched it in quite a while. What did stand out to me was Cruise's performance, which was just so, so in your face and more intense than any other individual. There's more intensity in the scenes he does in Magnolia than any individual scene in any other film he's done. So I appreciate it for that. Also, and Chris can see, I have a inordinately large frog collection. I actually just made a short called The Frog and the Furious, which is a Fast and the Furious parody entirely with frogs. I love frogs. So this part of this film, without doing spoilers, is always stuck in my mind.
Frogs feature prominently in Magnolia.
Thank God. Thank you for that, PTA. Moving on from Magnolia, Mission Impossible 2.
Oh, man. Okay, well, this is like a midpoint in terms of what the series was about. I would say up to 3, it was still sort of a spy movie, but it was increasingly an action movie. 2 is way more of an action movie than Mission Impossible 1, but it still has a quite extensive espionage plot. Not a smart one, like the one
in... It's just Notorious. It's the exact same plot as Notorious.
Yes, you're right, it is. It is the same plot as Notorious. Damn you, Robert Town. Robert Town wrote the script for this one, and Days of Thunder. This is the guy who wrote Chinatown and The Last Detail. Talk about selling out.
Okay, I have a qualification on that, but first, I just have to note that, you know what this Monday is, Chris? Monday the 18th of May?
Is it like everyone watch Mission Impossible 2 Day, or like, ride side saddle on a motorcycle or something like that? I don't know.
Well, I'll definitely be riding side saddle on a motorcycle through the national park as Tom Cruise is doing in this. This is going to make us feel old. It came out 20 years ago on Monday.
Mission Impossible 2. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so a little bit of an anniversary there. I like this movie because it showed Brighton Les Sands as a stop point for a major action sequence of lots of explosions, where it's just the place he used to go there as a kid and, you know, and hang around on the beach.
I have fun with this. It's a very bad movie, but it's so stupid that it is entertaining. The action scenes are not up to the standards of the best John Woo work, but are still really cool compared to most stuff you see coming out of Hollywood. It is also, though, like, when did Tom Cruise become like a John Woo bullet ballet kind of, you know, pirouetting, you know, like the jewel shooting and diving through the air. Suddenly he's an expert in all the John Woo type fighting.
But the action, and it's practically shot, whether it be the motorcycle ride, the stuff on the beach, the stuff where he rides the motorcycle through the flames after the car's exploded. It's really cool.
Yeah, it is actually really good.
It is real.
Yeah, it is actually really good. Did they rip off the gun in the sand trick in Bad Boys 2?
Yes, they did. Only 3 years later. Yeah. And we have to remember, though, this came out immediately after another prominent film shown in City of the Matrix, where everything had to be crazy and over the top and large life. Obviously, yeah. The Matrix,
this one,
and elements were befitting it more than Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah, and Mission Impossible 2 is, unlike The Matrix, is actually set in Sydney, though. The Matrix is, you know, in The Matrix, then we're not using Sydney iconography. Like, we filmed in the city, whereas like Mission Impossible 2 was like, here's the Sydney Opera House.
Yeah, this was at the time like Attack of the Clones, where the dollar was at a point where it was inexpensive enough for production offsets to set major films in Sydney. I really like walking around where and seeing in this film, knowing the locations now, a major set piece taking place. I think it's the Governor Phillip Tower, stuff happening around Mrs. Macquarie's chair, the Manly Heads, down in Brighton Les Sands, obviously the center of Sydney City. It's really fun just seeing Sydney casually used as the backdrop in all its glory. And remember, this is the time, it was perfectly timed, because this is when the entire world was looking at Sydney. The Olympics are about to happen. Everyone was talking about Sydney 2000. So this was, hey, before you get the Olympics, come see a bit about Sydney. So
it's a nice ad.
Very in the cultural zeitgeist. This is a very 2000 movie.
In so many ways. Style. Even just the name, like MI2. It's like ID4.
Yeah.
T2. Those names went out of fashion after MI2, I think. That was just it.
Yeah. Yeah. I rewatched this the other day. I've watched it. I saw it in cinemas too, and I watched it a few times over the years. It was my least favorite Mission Impossible type film. It's moved up in my rankings. The reason is, one is still my favorite, and it's a hallmark of action films for me. I think more in 2000 than now. It was so jarring to see the shift in tone from 1 to 2. With enough distance, I like it. I appreciate that it's an anthology series. And I like, as we talked about earlier, the just crazy, brilliant height of the action.
Hmm.
What does get me is...
I'm glad you've come around on that. I remember actually, I'm not sure whether it was just was off air or actually in a previous...
No, we were talking about Fallout and we had an extended bit. It was...
Yeah. I remember you hadn't seen MI2 in a while, and me and Virat were defending it for the same reasons. We were saying like the action is just so over the top that it becomes like, how can you not love this? And you were like, no, it's just stupid. I'm glad you've joined the team. Like that motorcycle bit at the end is just glorious.
Oh, it's great.
And it's so stupid, like him hanging on the side of a motorbike and shooting people with like no arms on the handlebars. Like it's so dumb, but it's great. It's really well executed
through the air. Nothing compared to catapulting himself backwards, kick someone in the face.
Yeah,
kicking a gun out of the sand.
Yeah,
jumping off the motorcycles and like attacking each other in midair.
Oh, man, I'm glad you've seen the light. And the thing is, like, John Woo executes it. Maybe it's the lack of CG everywhere. But I also think it's somehow more grounded than, say, like the propelling yourself at somebody else in the air, in midair in Fast and Furious 6 or whatever it was. Like when you compare it to the recent equivalents of over the top ridiculous action, it's somehow more tangible, even as it's similarly stupid.
I agree. It's a lot of fun to watch. And honestly, part of the reason I watched it now is I'm in the mood. We discussed weeks previously, bit of fun. Honestly, not to treat the prevailing situation as anything but very, very serious that it is, but it's nice to watch a film where Tom Cruise takes on a killer virus in Sydney and saves the day.
Yeah. True.
I do like it more than I did initially. I still have a number of issues with it. First of all, the whole plot is not just stupid, but it's excessively stupid in that the entire plot happens because Ethan Hunt went on a holiday. The replacement they got to send him in turned rogue, like everyone in the IMF does, and that starts the whole thing. They have a serious recruitment screening problem in this agency.
Yeah, this kind of stuff just keep happening.
Later is right. Yeah,
yeah.
Take your shit together, guys. What the hell?
Why are we always mobbing after IMF's mess?
Yeah, I also watched Fallout the other week, and there's the bit where the CIA director says, "I don't trust any of you to sort this out, so bring you all in the context of the film, like, what are you doing?" But watching Mission Impossible, so I'm thinking, this makes sense. Doing the right thing. You're the Iceman of the situation. You're clearly got your head screwed on right.
Well, interesting comparison. I think we're going to skip over Vanilla Sky, right? I haven't seen that since TV, like 10, 15 years ago.
And I'm going to say this for Last Samurai too. Vanilla Sky and Last Samurai, I saw them on TV, but I saw them disjointedly. I haven't seen the film in one sitting.
Me too, I've seen actually.
Sections over the years.
Films.
Yeah.
But you know.
I just avoided Vanilla Sky because actually, before we get into Vanilla Sky, can I just note one thing about Mission Impossible 2? It frustrates me that it's the same style of script as Mission Impossible 1, as in very noirish, but Woo's action.
Robert Town.
Robert Town. But the style is working against, the director's working against the style of the script. If De Palma directed it, it would have been much more clear what Town was going for. But here, Woo's more interested in showing the action set piece on the cliff than the interactions between the characters, which are so much more consequential. So that really did value the film for me.
I agree. Robert Town's... I mean, yeah, it's the guy who wrote Chinatown. He has a handle on this noirish style. And Brian De Palma is a guy who always pays tribute to classic crime films in particular. You know, perfect match. John Woo is more interested in this kind of romantic melodrama. John Woo is more interested in this strange romantic melodrama. So he's great at high emotion moments, you know, the peaks of the narrative, but not so good at actually making you care about the connective tissue along the way.
Yeah. I agree. I think it's a serious letdown of the film for me. I'm having said that, and in the space of you just kind of want to watch a film that doesn't take itself seriously at all, but is a really fun, intelligent kind of dumb. I know that's a weird thing to say, but it is very precise in how, in the level of dumb it's going for.
Yeah,
and that works.
It's very watchable.
It's Mission Impossible 2, Vanilla Sky. I haven't seen the film in its entirety, so I don't want to comment on it. I avoided it at the time because just the parodically bad reviews. It was like a cat's of its time where everyone just said, this is the worst thing. What is Tom Cruise doing?
I haven't seen it in a long, long time, but I was intrigued by it as a kid. I guess I just need to watch the Spanish one, Open Your Eyes, that it's based on. Also starring Penelope Cruz in the same role.
Yeah. So Vanilla Sky.
Minority Report, right? Is that
Minority next? Report is next. A film that I saw with my optometrist father in cinemas, and he had a lot to say about all the stuff with the eyes. Like, Glenn, this can never happen. This is wrong. It's wrong. It's very practical. But my dad took me to this.
I thought he might. My optometrist dad didn't voice any complaints about that. He was just like, yeah, it's a good movie.
So, Chris, this is real. This can happen. Take care of your eyes.
So Colin Farrell. I like it too. Colin Farrell plays the Iceman role in this one.
Yeah, Colin Farrell, early Colin Farrell. It just shows how good he was going to be. And he was he was good in this.
But he is good in this. Star power. Yeah, he's great. But yeah, everything his character says from the very beginning, you know, there's plot reasons why he's framed in such a way and we're made to dislike him. But everything he's saying all along makes perfect sense. Like, I'm here to investigate this thing before it gets rolled out nationwide. Seems like something funny could maybe go on with this. Raises some questions we'd like to investigate further. And it's like...
He comes in and says, why shouldn't we be questioning whether there's any flaws in the system? And everyone's like, what are you talking about? We're stopping murders. Shut up, suited government guy.
Exactly.
No. You're the good guy. You're on point.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like he has that cocky kind of arrogance about him, you know, that leads you to think, oh, maybe he's a bad guy, or you know, it's easy to frame him as bad, but it's like he could be the protagonist of the movie and played by Tom Cruise with a similar kind of cockiness, and you could be easily be manipulated to go along with this guy.
But then it could have almost happened, but then there's that great moment when I love the scene in the lift where he realizes that the siren's going off and that he thinks, oh shit, Tom Cruise is about to kill me. And at that point, you know, no one is overcoming Cruise's character's sheer level of confidence. So we know the protagonist very clearly, but yes, he could have been the lead.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise could have played both of them could have played either role respectively. And also Max von Sydow passed away recently. Really good in this.
Really good. Max von Sydow could do a role like this in his sleep. And he does, you know.
I think he did.
Yeah, he's great. Effortlessly great. Yeah.
We have to acknowledge, though, that they rip off the shot from LA Confidential where Kevin Spacey's character is shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's taken direct. I saw it. I'm like, wait a minute. That film was 6 years ago. We've seen this. It's very obvious.
LA Confidential made a big impact.
Yeah, still a great film.
Yeah. So Minority Report, I do like, but I don't like as much as a lot of people, I think, because I find it kind of weird and tonally a mess. I think it has a great concept, and I think it actually picks up towards the end in the lead up to the final act change in particular. I think is just Spielberg at his best in the kind of contraption filmmaking where you're seeing characters playing to what they're being told is going to happen. And the way it's choreographed, as well as just the intrigue of the plot, fantastic. But it has the same big flaw, I think, that his film he was making at the same time, AI, has, which is badly placed humor that clashes with the tone of the film. The movie generally has this kind of grim look and feel, but there's strange comic relief, for example, in this sequence where Tom Cruise is running from the jetpack guys, which is just...
And it's this wacky sort of music, or near wacky music.
The whole thing, the whole scene actually is really wacky. Like just the look of it with these guys flying all over the place. And like, it's like Keystone Cops kind of thing, you know, just like slapstick pitfalls. And it's like, aren't these meant to be the fearsome futuristic cop squad that we saw at the beginning of the movie.
They all become stormtroopers suddenly.
It's just, actually the whole thing is like, this movie would be better if it were less of an action film. Like early on at the tail end of that sequence is like a fist fight between Colin Farrell and Tom Cruise on assembly lines at a car factory. And it's like,
which ends with a really cool shot in fairness.
It does. Yes. But it's like, aren't these two guys just like basically really good, but ordinary cops who skew towards the bureaucrat angle these days? Like, you know, how they're both like suddenly James Bond.
All right. So Tom Cruise, I understand if he's James Bond, because his role is to go in, as we see the opening sequence, and do these crazy stuff.
That's true, yeah. But
Colin Farrell's characterization is very much like Jeremy Renner's characterization in Mission Impossible 4, where, yeah, they're a bureaucrat, but they actually have this darker side. They're there for a reason in that function. Again, Jeremy Renner is playing the Iceman in Mission Impossible 4. We'll get to that one later. On the matter of the humor, there's one bit of humor in this film that works really well, where he's going through with the new eyes and it gets scanned and he's like, "Hello, Mrs. X. I hope you enjoyed that."
He's like, "What?"
We'll get to the technology in a sec. The place where it was in most stark contrast and came off worst was in the aforementioned eye sequence with Peter Stormare. Peter Stormare is playing this quirky character, but Peter Stormare is only really good if he's doing comedy at really dark Fargo-esque comedy. And it was really off kilter here.
Yeah, but it's not as off kilter as like the weird slapstick and like the let's see how, you know, the person playing saxophone reacts when someone flies through their window. Really broad type stuff we had earlier. But yeah,
That belongs in Tomorrow Never Dies in the sequence where the motorcycle falls into the houses. Like that's what I think it was riffing off that sort of style a little.
I reckon it's kind of like a classic film comedy thing.
Dark movie. This is a movie about child abduction.
Yeah, this movie's dark.
Who are enslaved in this goo to.
It looks dark. It has creepy imagery. It has this.
Seeing where she's screaming and it's running the house?
Yeah, it has this bleak, desaturated look to it. Nightmare technology all over the place, like the way that they keep people in storage. Yeah, there was no place for goofy humor in this. But. No. Also, there's moments where the script is just kind of like too dumb. Like when he talks to the lady who...
In the greenhouse.
Yeah, and she's...
Of course she's gardening, like this character is in every other movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Wouldn't she call the cops right away?
Exactly, but she speaks in movie catchphrases and does everything in the most dramatic way. And it's just like, this could have been written a lot better.
But I don't want to ruin the ending, but the twist is really good as to how the murder that happened some years ago took place. But to believe that the events that immediately followed happened in the manner which they did, it's a fascinating concept, but it's a bit of a stretch in a film that's really trying to be grounded and gritty and realistic.
Yeah.
On the matter of realism, this film has aged exceptionally well. It doesn't look nearly as futuristic now as it did in 2002. A lot of the stuff has come to pass with how we interact with tech, ads, and how they engage us.
Some of it is
eye scanning.
Yeah, that's right. But it's interesting. A few little things where it's like, okay, they didn't quite see how that would work. Like they detect him when he moves on the train, but they don't detect. From an eye scan, but they don't detect Anderton when just regular subway ads scan him and recognize his name. And you know, we all know now that if corporations were using an ID detecting technology, that would definitely be linked up with a government system where any wanted criminal would get triggered straight away. It doesn't ultimately matter, but it's just one of those things.
I'm kind of glad that in 02 that everyone involved was, everyone considered wasn't trying to commodify and consolidate all of our data, at least wasn't ways to do so. So I'm going to give the film a bit of leeway in that regard. Yeah. But yes, sadly, it does not hold up.
Yeah, and you know, they
good predictive qualities.
There's another cute one in here, which is on the train, everyone's looking at amazing newspapers with moving images on them instead of just using a phone.
Yeah.
It's like
definitely does not hold up.
we can find ways to make paper, you know, hold a display on it. But yeah.
Why has that always been a thing, like moving images on t-shirts? No, that people just haven't gone there.
I think it's just the desire for a still picture to move has always been there. You know, cinema fulfilled that in some way, but then it's like, you know, you've got to have the moving paintings like in Harry Potter, and you've got to have the moving t-shirt and the photos that move on newspapers. We just want to ruin the art of photography.
Oh, so I've got to say, I'm willing to let this slide because it's such a good movie, but there's a basic logical flaw at the premise of this film where the sequence of events which would cause Jonathan to go on the run and be accused of a murder would not have happened but for he's having gone on the run in the first place.
Oh yeah, it's an interesting
time travel paradox that's in a lot of science fiction films.
It's an interesting contradiction, but they didn't explore it in Minority Report, but I'm okay with that because I don't think we're going to go into total spoilers of the entire movie here, but I can foresee him without having gone on the run ending up in that same situation. Like if he just was given a phone call, for example, and tipped off on an ordinary day, days later.
Yeah, I forgive it because
it's
a universe where it's plausible and the film's just so damn good. I don't care that much.
But it could work in such a way that there are branching timelines that all sort of end up at this destination.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah.
Minority Report, great movie, possibly Cruise's most underrated and the first of two collaborations of Spielberg, the other of which is not good.
I haven't seen War of the Worlds in ages. Look, it's nowhere near as good as Minority Report. Minority Report has the really cool sci-fi concept and visuals going for it. And the whole idea of being unable to escape fate, great. War of the Worlds similarly has amazing visual design and amazing sci-fi concepts. Just the emergence scene, the concept of how the aliens are harvesting people to create their terraforming liquid, you know, again, terrifying.
Everything had to be the Matrix.
Yeah, true. But it is a terrifying visual. I think Spielberg, the visualist, is in very fine form in this film. And I think the script is not nearly that good.
Right. On War of the Worlds, I really don't like this film. It's probably my least favorite Tom Cruise film. I really like the book. I like the Orson Welles
radio play.
I've listened to it. I've actually got it behind me on my one of the few tape decks I have. It's great.
Nice.
The original 50s movie is quite good. But the 50s movie highlights what's really bad about this, and it leads into the worst qualities of both Spielberg and Cruise in that they've taken a story that is a really strong metaphor for concerns about foreign influence and foreign invasion and the impact of the other and turned it and distilled it to its less consequential and stimulating elements, which are its action, and just gone with that. Cruise obviously is an action star, but this is entirely an action-driven film in what is not an action-driven narrative, but is still trying to have the grandeur of it. Spielberg, too, he can do grand storytelling, but he's really just interested in the action here, and it leads to an action-oriented flick, likes of which we've seen so many times before. So much is based on War of the Worlds. We've seen so much come in the wake of the 50s films. So many have done it better, including likes of Independence Day, which was at that point incredibly saturated. We didn't need this. No one needed this film.
No, but
it doesn't add anything to the genre or oeuvre.
I would argue that the main thing it added, which was fresh at the time, was the very 9/11 inspired imagery of the emergence and the attacks initially by the aliens. And just a way of visualizing that kind of terror. That's probably the biggest contribution of the film and probably what's best about it. I think the action sequences in general are great. I think that the scene where they hide in the basement and the aliens come down beyond, the aliens are a goofy design, is a great suspense piece. Yeah, I think the film has a lot going for it. It just has not very interesting characters. And a not convincing script.
As a reflection on 9/11, we have to remember this is only a few, it's still a very raw incident. It's only a few, then it was even then only a few years since. I don't think we needed a literal articulation of it. If we were to get one, there were other films in production at the time which more directly focused on the incident, which were much better,
but,
and which gave a better conception of not only what it was like to be there on the day, but the lasting impact.
I don't know, man. I think the just in terms of updating the way that we depict mass destruction, I think it had some value. And I do think that initial emergence is really scary. Just the sound and the image. Yeah.
I don't, because again, I compare it to like the 50s film where you see it come out of the ground and it just starts going from one person to another. But here it's just such larger scale destruction, at least at the beginning, that you don't have you don't have an idea of the personal. Yes, later in the film, later in each of the War of the Worlds narratives, it goes to a more macro level, and that's where it belongs. But at the beginning, you needed the more intimate focus, which all the adaptations got, and this was just too generalized to really hit home, as I think it was hoping to, because you just see the thing, this giant thing come out of the ground, and people, not the foreground, even people we know, but the background just gets zapped. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different tone. I'm not a fan. We skipped a couple of Cruise films, by the way.
Yeah.
Including Last Samurai, which I haven't seen in its entirety in one go.
I remember
there being one fantastic sequence early beginning when he trains a gun on a soldier and threatens to shoot him if he doesn't shoot Tom Cruise first, and the soldier misses, i.e. simulating an onslaught into battle and how they're not ready. That scene was great. The rest of the movie I didn't like so much, at least what I saw of it. But I haven't seen the whole thing, so I'll refrain from commenting.
I agree. It's very generic, very stock standard. But yeah, I haven't seen it in ages. So we should talk about one we skipped, though, which I think is one of his best performances and just a great
Absolutely.
Movie. Collateral.
I saw this in cinemas, and I rewatched it about a month ago now. It is starring Tom Cruise and Jamie Foxx. It's Michael Mann. Tom Cruise plays the bad guy for once, properly, like a proper straight-up bad guy for once.
It attracted a lot of attention at the time, casting Cruise in this role, but he's perfect for it because his character, like Cruise himself, is sometimes so polished that there's a mystery of what's really behind the charm and the pretty face. So in this character, it is all surface, you know, the nice suit. Tom Cruise is a silver fox, looking great, by the way. But yeah, the nice suit.
Can we even now call Tom Cruise a silver fox? I appreciate he has silver hair in this, but he looks like 30.
He's a Richard Gere.
Like, I want to look like Tom Cruise when I'm 56. God damn it!
Right? Yeah. He looks great, but his character is psychopath, you know. But again, it's a great harnessing of Cruise's blankness. I think he can be a really expressive actor, but I do think there can be a blankness to him. And yeah, his character is just so like sharp and pointed.
I also love how before this, after this, there's so many moralizing, expositing, philosophical hitmen. Cruise maybe did it best because all the soliloquies, all the stuff he comes out with, it works with not just him trying to justify it to himself and the audience, but egging the Jamie Foxx character to go along with him. So it serves a narrative function, but also you have these long car rides through the gorgeous renderings of New York City by Mann, where a bit of reflection works in the lower, in the lower moments amidst a much more acute, more singular and highly stylized good depictions of action cinema.
Yeah.
The balance works really well.
Yeah. This is the first full digital film. I think Mann, yeah, he played with digital cameras with Ali. And I wonder if he picked up this project just because he thought, oh, Taxi Cab at Night, that's a perfect demo that's a perfect demo for the capabilities of digital cameras. This was a script originally written by Australian writer Stuart Beattie, who went on to direct the film of Tomorrow When the War Began. But yeah, the script had, there's no credits on it. Yeah. I doubt the script was anywhere near as good as the film we have now. There have been some uncredited rewrites by first Frank Darabont and then Michael Mann to get to the version that on screen now, which feels very Michael Mann. The depiction of the police activity and the investigative side of it is so Mann. But yeah, this film is a great high concept kind of thriller. You know, I am chained to this guy doing evil deeds. What do I do? It's visually beautiful. I love how crisp and elegant Mann's imagery is at the same time that he's seeking a realistic, you are there documentary look. He manages to strike that balance between naturalism and poeticism in a way that I don't think anybody else who is making these kind of handycam action thriller type movies ever has. It's really well plotted. The final full circle kind of reveal is maybe a little bit of a stretch, but it's possible.
Massive. No, it's. I think it goes beyond the levels of plausibility.
It's not implausible. I appreciate
they're in the same location, but it's too much of a stretch.
Well, I actually agree with you. I just mean it's not implausible to the sense of like, I am completely checking out of the movie. This would not happen. But it definitely is a setback where you think this more than likely, it's more than that. I agree. You can't watch it without thinking, really, but it's not totally implausible.
It's going for such a tone of, it's not just
crazy coincidence,
but wanting to Tom Cruise and Mann wanting to impress so much upon you. And it's trying to go for a searing philosophical edge. It doesn't work when you have what is such a convoluted twist. I know it could happen, but the odds of it happening are just too much for me.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a twist that belongs in Mission Impossible.
Right, yeah.
On the ending, I like it stylistically. What actually happens on the train doesn't make sense to me, but just watching it back and watching it 15 years ago, but I like the way the sequence plays out. Not as much as the club sequence. The club sequence is amazing.
All the action scenes are great. The final one on the end on the train, that what happened could have happened. It's just the way that it's visually staged maybe needs to be tweaked to be more believable.
Yeah, I could, that is a failing of the film.
But I could totally buy that event happening.
But Michael Mann has, this amidst the shaky cam aesthetic, has a very deliberate direction in the entire film up until that point where he just lets it go. I feel he lets it go a little.
I agree. What else is there to say about Collateral?
I like Jada Pinkett Smith.
Yep.
I like all the actors in this. They're all good.
Yeah, it's interesting to see Mark Ruffalo so young playing the kind of role
Ruffalo. So different. Hollywood's never known quite what to do with him.
Yeah, he's a strange actor. He belongs more, I think, in indie films.
But I don't have really much to say.
The Hulk. Yeah, basically, I love Michael Mann. I love that Tom Cruise finally got to play a villain. My sister always used to say that she found Tom Cruise creepy. I agree. There is that creepy side to him. There's something like not natural. We talk about how oversized he is and that in his dramatic presentation, but the larger-than-life persona can be really entertaining in the context of a film, but he's not a person who often projects things in a way that causes, you know, that drives real empathy. Would you agree with that? Like that it's more abstracted because there's so much showmanship to it. In that regard, playing a psychopath, I think, is perfect.
I think what you're talking about befits narrative-driven drama, plot-driven drama, rather than character-driven drama. Cruise, and I was really saving to talk about this later when we talk about his lesser and a few of the films he's done in the past few years, when he's moved from character-driven stuff to plot-driven stuff, it's never been as strong. This is a little different in that it has a very strong plot. It's very clear. It's incredibly plot-driven, but the characters are very distinct and very, very strong. When the car flip happens, it's amazing, but I absolutely believe it would happen. And the inversion of everything we've come to know about Tom Cruise, it was the first time he'd played a fallen out villain. It was great. He was willing to experiment a little more. He's always wanted to build this image of being a larger than life great guy, but he's at the point in his career, far beyond the point in his career, where he can play more than one villainous role and his public persona wouldn't change. Compare it to Tom Hanks, where he's experienced with the villains a few times,
yeah,
his persona has absolutely not changed.
The thing is, people love Collateral, you know?
So it's why, a great movie. It's one of his better ones.
Absolutely. But people love this movie. It's still really popular. Why has he not played a villain again?
I think that's when we're going to go on to talk about next. Around this time, he started to change his focus in films. He just did that cameo in Goldmember. He's about to do Mission Impossible 3. But remember, this is the time when there's a bit of a public backlash against Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
People are... South Park happened.
Well, look, the promo, this actually was all launched from the interviews he was doing to promote Mission Impossible 3, actually. So a lot of people think that the MI3 box office was greatly affected by Cruise's antics and outbursts at the time.
Yeah. I mean, South Park, at that point, had never had an episode even temporarily shelved, but the allegedly, as it was reported by some outlets, Tom Cruise exercised power through Paramount and got the episode moved along for a bit. It was ultimately aired, but then that engendered even more notoriety and controversy in it. Mm. It lent to the public perception that this was a guy that was only overly intense, but took himself way too seriously,
yeah,
which meant that now he had to start doing roles, A, where he could show he doesn't take himself seriously, Tropic Thunder, Goldmember, great cameos, more of a Tropic Thunder, which we'll get to in a minute, but roles where it shows that he is a caring family guy, like in his next film, Mission Impossible 3, where he has a partner, where he's organizing parties for her, but he's still looking after his recruits and trying to do his Mission Impossible thing.
Interesting, because I was thinking that this look at me, I'm such a nice guy kind of thing about his later roles, especially the Mission Impossible series, which is his baby as a producer, was as a response to the backlash for Scientology. But that, you know, would have predate the Mission Impossible 3 would predate that, you know,
yes,
the back. Yeah. I wonder if it was just J.J. Abrams' touch taking it in a soap opera type direction, because that's his bread and butter. And it also
the time of him getting together with Katie Holmes, wanting to promote this family image.
Yeah, I also think maybe Tom Cruise was thinking, I'm at that point in my career, I want to be known more as a family person. I'm together with Katie Holmes, we're a family.
Well, the world's trying to accomplish that too.
Yeah.
Slater just looking after his son in the Dakota Fanning character.
He's not playing like the hotshot maverick anymore. It's like, now I'm a dad, I have responsibilities.
He's not chasing Kelly McGillis. He's settled down and just wants to protect Joyce.
Yep.
Mission Impossible 3. God.
Strange one.
It's my least favorite of the series.
I agree. It's the worst. It's
pretty much Alias, the feature version of Alias.
It's very Alias-esque. The actually
Ronan-esque. This rabbit's foot. What is this rabbit's foot? Ronan did it better 10 years before.
The plot isn't that interesting. Neither is the action. Too much CG.
Except I will give credit to the amazing running sequence through Shanghai and Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's goddamn incredible at elevating this otherwise incredibly boring villain Owen Davian's arms dealer.
That's the thing. I wasn't that impressed by Hoffman, even though I agree his performance is great, just because I always have difficulty engaging when the writing is that bad. His character is way less interesting than the way he plays it.
But then he has the best individual sequences. The sequences where he's threatening him on the plane, the sequence where he's holding his partner hostage, and the bit in the bathroom in the Vatican when it's Tom Cruise, it's Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Ethan Hunt, playing Philip Seymour Hoffman. And
they had some fun with the masks on this one.
Yeah. They had so much fun with masks until number six, which had the best use of them after number one.
Number two, the ridiculous twist.
Oh, that's right, with Richard Roxburgh. Okay, that was something. That was pretty great. Also, Tom Cruise showing himself, with Tom Cruise playing Doug Ray Scott's character, a bit of you as Tom Cruise as a villain in that. Also, well done on rewatch. I'd forgotten about that scene, hadn't seen the film in a few years. I really don't have much to say about Mission Impossible 3. I'll note that I don't like the sequence where he swings through between the buildings in Shanghai, because it's so obviously CGI.
Yeah.
And the series, the cachet of it, the appeal of it is what he does later. The Burj Khalifa scene, all the practical effects that Tom Cruise lent himself to, they're so much better than any bad crude CGI, which J.J. Abrams used in number three.
But between those two, we have a couple of I'm a Nice Guy movies, right? Valkyrie
and Lions for Lambs. Okay, I watched Lions for... I haven't seen Lions for Lambs. I watched the first half yesterday. Excuse me for not finishing it.
It's that bad? About, I heard it was bad. I never bothered to watch it.
Yeah, well, it was more timing, but yeah, it is that bad. It's about... Tom Cruise plays a senator who's being interviewed by a reporter played by Meryl Streep. It also stars Andrew Garfield, Robert Redford. It's directed by Robert Redford. I think it's also written by Robert Redford. I'll just check that. It pains me to say this, but Robert Redford is probably my favorite actor, but in this, he is not at all a good director, or I believe potentially screenwriter. I'm just trying to...
I think he just directed it.
Yeah, he just directed it. Yeah. The problem with this is it comes off the invasion of the Iraq War, and it was one of the first films to prominently talk, like Green Zone, to talk about what is the fallout, what has happened here. America is still very much, it's still very much at the forefront of the news, and it's trying to exposit and digest and come out with a view as to what is the right and wrong here, what is the view of the American public. And the problem is every character, every sequence reads like it was transcribed from several New York Times articles. It's a lot of criticism. I don't disagree with a lot of the politics in this movie, or at least a lot of the views that some of the characters put forward. It's just that every character is designed for a particular view and function. Everything is calculated. Everything is mechanical. Everything is philosophizing.
Preachy liberal movies.
Sorry?
You know, the preachy liberal movie tradition.
Oh, yeah. And it's clear, like, Cruise doesn't ever really get into politics. And it's clear, however, from this and Born on the 4th of July that he does have a political bent, and this is about as far as we could probably get to talk about it. It's clear he is relatively left-wing. He's clearly not au fait with a lot of what his character is spouting here. I compare it to an Aaron Sorkin film from about the same time, Charlie Wilson's War, where Tom Hanks plays a character plays a not dissimilar function. He's a congressman in that. I didn't like that film either. It's probably Aaron Sorkin's weakest work, at least from a feature perspective.
Weak work from Mike Nichols as well.
Yeah. It's just this film is so clunky and obvious and painstaking in trying to make its point to you that it loses any sense of a dramatic arc or tension or rhythm. I granted I haven't seen the whole thing, but based on the first half, I wouldn't recommend it. It also wastes Andrew Garfield in one of his very early prominent roles.
That's how it always is when people are starting out.
Yeah. So not Tom Cruise's best work, and not working to his action persona either. So that's Lions for Lambs. Valkyrie, I saw this on release. I didn't like it very much. It's about the Valkyrie plot for a number of German soldiers during the Second World War, to kill Hitler. And again, this has been reoriented, this story, it's a famous story, it's a well-known one. It's been reorientated as an action flick, but much more interesting and important from this story, and it's dealt with in relatively fleetingly, is the dilemma faced by not just the German soldiers, but by a number of others immediately prior and once the plot has happened, as to what side they take, what side they come out of this on, the political machinations around it, the sense of personal risk versus ultimate reward. The impression they give is that many in the high command didn't want Hitler to obviously remain in power or survive, and slight spoilers here for those who haven't seen the film, but it is a matter of historical record. While it wasn't apparent immediately, Hitler did obviously survive the plot, and the machinations around that, which are held in only a couple of scenes, are much more interesting than the actual action-oriented stuff of it, all the rest of the movie and how it's depicted. So,
yeah, I've only watched bits of this on TV. I've never seen it all the way through. I agree.
Wasn't a fan.
It's bland. Thunder.
Thunder. Tom Cruise plays Harvey Weinstein, Hollywood producer.
Basically, I reckon there's a few horror producers, characters rolled into one, but it's almost definitely mostly Harvey Weinstein. The whole, you know, like fat producer who goes on tirades and abuses people, the look, it's so Harvey Weinstein.
I don't think Tom Cruise ever made a Harvey Weinstein film.
No, you're right. I wonder if this film had something to do with that.
Yeah, we have to remember. Sadly, Harvey Weinstein was a very extremely powerful figure in Hollywood at the time, and Tom Cruise may have been the only act, one of the only actors, and not the only actor who could have pulled this off and completely gone away with it. Like, he's so patently, obviously,
Harvey Weinstein.
Parroting Weinstein.
Yeah.
Len Grossman.
A lot of people hated him, Weinstein, you know, behind the scenes, but he was too powerful.
Yeah. I like the intensity Cruise brings to this from a comic perspective. The sequence where he's staring down Matthew McConaughey and explaining why it's more beneficial to have the Ben Stiller character, I've forgotten his name, great name, killed rather than survive, is just so funny. And then he just starts dancing, obviously, which is brought back as a refrain later of the credits from Cruise's amazing dancing sequence. The bits where he's just drinking coffee and swearing. He doesn't do a lot of comedy in major roles. Night and Day is an exception we'll get to in a minute, but this gold member, even as fleeting as it was, showed how good he can be with comedy. Though, to be fair, I think a lot of that depends on subverting our understanding of who Tom Cruise is. A lot of this is only funny because
it's Tom Cruise,
and it's funny to see Tom Cruise in this role.
And that you look at him and you don't see Tom Cruise, because Tom Cruise's attractiveness and his look has always been such a big part of Tom Cruise, right? And here on his fat, he's extremely balding, big beard,
but suspenders,
sunglasses,
not a guy.
Yeah, it's really funny watching Tom Cruise go apeshit. He's always had a talent for going apeshit. We saw it in Magnolia. We saw it in A Few Good Men. We saw it in Jerry Maguire. It's funny to see an entire role about that side of Tom Cruise.
And he wasn't forefront in the marketing. So you get into the film and you remember thinking, is that Tom Cruise?
Yeah.
I remember being in the cinemas and thinking that. And
it was the thing about the movie. It was you've got to see this. You'll never believe Tom Cruise, what he's doing here.
Yeah. But, and that and the early opening sequence of Scorcher 1 through 6 are my favorite parts of the film. But we have to recognize that this is very much playing into Cruise's persona of, I need to be seen now as someone who doesn't take himself too seriously and can laugh at himself and just a regular guy who likes comedy like you. This is really, and this leads on to one of his most underrated films, Night and Day, where
such a Tom Cruise role. Like, it could not be anyone but Tom Cruise. I wonder if it was written knowing that it would be Tom Cruise.
I think Brad Pitt could maybe do it, but not as good as Tom Cruise.
It's so just like the winning smile and the cocky arrogance, you know, the charmer. It's like Jerry Maguire, Tom Cruise in an action movie.
I love, so he's a spy. It's out of that comedy where he meets Cameron Diaz and falls for her. But the theatrics around him being a spy, he can do more large life acrobatic stuff and aeronautics than he could otherwise, his characters could otherwise do in other movies. And it's an IMF type force he's obviously working with, but it's played for laughs and comedy as he tries to acclimatize Cameron Diaz to this lifestyle. The scene where he jumps on the car is like, hi, I'm back. Just wanted to say hi, hold on, I'm going to shoot these guys. The scene where he's walking through the warehouse and bullets are just flying everywhere and he doesn't care because he knows he's Tom Cruise and he's not getting shot.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
Yeah, this is a fun, easy watch. It reminds me of a lot of 80s action comedy type stuff. I think it was out of sync with the trends of the time, which is why it bombed, as well as maybe because of the backlash against Tom Cruise at the time. I mean, I think most of his films post Mission Impossible 3 underperformed for quite a while, right?
Yeah, he was seen as a little passe to the point of, in the next film, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, they were trying to replace him with Jeremy Renner. Brand's function, that character's introduction, was to see him continue the franchise. What it became clear following that and during that and the reception of that film, Cruise was A, so popular, B, was the only one willing to do these insane stunts, and people wanted to see it. They just kept going. He was relegated to a minor role in number 5. Jeremy Renner's nowhere to be seen in Fallout. And everyone, and Tom Cruise's cachet has picked up to the point where he's Jack Reacher, who's doing more and more stuff. People like him much more again.
Was Jeremy Renner really intended to replace Tom Cruise?
That's the rumor.
I saw it as definitely a possible, like, we're training a mentor type role, but I never thought that he would actually replace him.
It seems very apparent for his characterization that he's part of the team now, that they can bring him into the movie. Hey, Tom Cruise is on holiday, but you, Jeremy Renner, can do this now. It's kind of like with the Bourne, whatever terrible Bourne Jeremy Renner was in.
Fortunately, for Tom Cruise. He is the producer of the movie, so he could, of course, give himself all the best stunts and do what he could to win over audiences' trust and love again. And so we have it.
Yeah, no disparagement on Jeremy Renner. I have no idea how game this dude is for stunts, but would Jeremy Renner or anyone else be game to walk outside the Burj Khalifa and then run down it and across it? I don't know. I give Cruise pretty strong credit in that regard. Also, on a bit of a tangent, but aside from Collateral, are there any films, and aside from Collateral and one other film he did very recently in his career, are there any films where Tom Cruise's character dies? He doesn't do death scenes.
Spoilers for Collateral. No, I don't think anyone is too shocked by that. No, you're right. I think it's just because of the way that he's always playing these. Cruise, he's always going to be front and center.
New death. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's Night and Day. Ghost Protocol. We talked about it when we talked about Fallout.
Look, the Burj Khalifa stunt is just so incredible. It was amazing to see in IMAX. It really defines the film. I think the movie as a whole is really fun. I love the tone they strike. I think there's a nice cleanness to the action scenes. Thank you, Brad Bird. Yeah, it's fun.
First live action feature.
Yeah.
Yep. The Burj Khalifa is the best stunt in the entire series. It's the best stunt Cruise has ever done. It's one of the best stunts ever committed to film, and I don't know if they're ever going to be able to top it. I'm here for Mission Impossible 7 and 8, and I'm here for the space movie he's going to do. But to see him go up it, to run down it, and then run across it, and they kept that. They didn't release all that footage for the trailers and promotional material, which was very smart. They just teased us with Tom Cruise sitting on top of the bloody tower. Incredible stuff.
I agree, dude. Definitely one of the best stunts of all time. As you say, such so immensely better than the CG swing he does in MI3. But yeah, this moment is where Cruise's career shifted. This is where it became all about doing these incredible stunts. Like, that just became the prevailing mission of his career at this point.
To note a couple of things about that film. I loved some of the early sequences, the sequence where the other agent throws the bag down and shoots the bullets up to hit the henchman who's running after him. There's a lot of great set pieces. Just on the
action is just so well done.
Oh God, it's so good. And the Kremlin scene is really funny.
Mm. It's playful. Same as the scene in the infiltration of in India. Not to the same extent as the Kremlin scene, but yeah, it's funny.
Yeah. Two things I really liked about my two favorite things about the Burj Khalifa sequence. When just before he jumps out the window, they have that shot of him like just standing against the wall, like drawing in breath. It's that moment of where, like, the same thing as John McClane, where he's about to jump off the tower. Instead of saying, "I'm going to do this and I'm an action superstar," he says, "Please let me die. Please let me die." It's showing enough vulnerability to make to ground the scene, render it more believable. If it had just been Tom Cruise, Mission Impossible 2 style, flying on a motorcycle through flames, I don't think it would have worked as well. But knowing he was a little bit older, felt a little bit more vulnerable, made the scene work much better. Also, and it's one of my favorite shots in modern cinema, but the incredible shot, the pan down as he's running down the side of the tower and the skyscrapers come into view below us.
That's amazing.
Wonderful. What a beautiful, beautiful image. And then Cruise running along the side of the building. Just gorgeous. Wonderful stuff. Thank you, Brad Bird. Rock of Ages?
More fun goofing around from Tom Cruise.
He's your guy.
Yeah, he's your guy. But it's interesting how the newcomers cast in the lead roles are so bland and boring. The real appeal.
Diego something something and Courtney from the Footloose remake. I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name. I'll bring it up. We have here Diego Boneta and Julianne Hough. Okay. I had the great pleasure of seeing the original runs of this on Broadway and the West End. It works as a stage jukebox musical. It's really good because there is an artifice to coming in and singing these songs randomly that Mamma Mia, the movie adaptation, nailed and musical nailed, but does not translate in terms of Rock of Ages. They also change a lot of the good plotting elements. In the original production, it's these Germans who are trying to come in and buy up the whole place. In this, it's about Catherine Zeta-Jones and censorship. it just doesn't land as well. The hokiness works in theater. Moreover, the casting of the leads is bad compared to any of the major productions. The Lonnie, the Russell Brand character, in the stage version, he breaks the fourth wall a lot. He's the narrator. It doesn't work because they have a much more reduced role for him in Rock of It in the movie, but you needed that function more. The scene, the I Can't Fight This Feeling scene that he has with Alec Baldwin is really awkward compared to it being incredibly camp and much more openly so in the any stage production where it's much better. The whole movie is about, it has to be upbeat, whereas the musical, it didn't have as happy an ending. It went for a very different tone. It was much better. We just, with this movie, it was like, no, it has to be, we all have to win in the end. It didn't work. It's also a lot more conservative in its approach. But I don't want to, but that would be speaking to spoilers, simply to say that the film has relatively conservative attitudes to sex.
Yeah.
Compared to stage musical. And why can't people feel just a little open? A stage seems, people just, with a lot of stage movie adaptations, people seem to be just a little bit conservative. It happened with Cats too.
Especially because this is,
I don't know why. Obviously, well, apparently what flies on stage doesn't fly in the movies.
Because theater goers are deviants and movies are the entertainment of the masses. It's Rock of Ages, you know, it's about hard rock. It doesn't have to be so clean.
And it's saturated bad covers of rock compared to the musical. Having said that, one good thing about it is Tom Cruise's Stacey Jacks. He actually improves upon the performance he played on Broadway and the West End. He's funny. He's cover of Dead or Alive by Bon Jovi.
Yeah, it's really good.
Bloody fantastic. Pour Some Sugar on Me and Don't Stop Believing are okay. A little diminishing returns there. But what a Dead or Alive. He had Axl Rose as a voice coach. And I believe Tom Cruise as an aging, larger-than-life rock star, because goddammit, it's Tom Cruise. And he learned to sing for this. He elevated what was otherwise just a lousy, lousy movie. Just disappointing. Jack Reacher's next.
I have nothing to add. Yeah. Jack Reacher. I don't like the Jack Reacher movies.
No, I don't like them either. And I don't have a problem with the books. I've read a couple. They're enjoyable. I think they're pretty generic compared to the time material Tom Cruise is used to working on. But moreover, they're as much as Jack Reacher is a very distinct character, and Tom Cruise should never have been cast. He doesn't have the physical presence, the not just screen presence, but physical presence. There's a distinction, important distinction to be drawn there, that the role of Jack Reacher requires. Jack Reacher's like 6'5". He's hulking. Tom Cruise is very emblematic in anything he's in, but he doesn't have the physical, he doesn't fill the frame like Jack Reacher is supposed to. There's other things about it, but moreover, Jack Reacher is so plot orientated. Cruise should always be doing character orientated work. Why is he in this relatively standard thriller? Why did he choose to make two of these? I think it's a really bad career call.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. Yeah, because it's a popular book series, popular hero for him.
But Tom Cruise is bigger than Jack Reacher.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't really say. The first one has an amusing Werner Herzog performance as the villain.
What is it? Are you so tough that you'd bite off your own fingers? Bite off your own fingers. I have to prove you're tough. It's like, yeah, great stuff. Oh, and we build bridges. We're evil. We build bridges. We strengthen communities.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
Jack Reacher 2 is
so bad.
Generic. What's there to talk about? But like, we have now entered into just I am an action hero phase of his career. Jack Reacher's 1 and 2, The Mummy, and then Mission Impossible 5 and 6.
Yeah.
I have not seen The Mummy. I've heard only bad things and seen a few scenes from it.
All I'll say is this. The original Mummy, which also is celebrating its 20th anniversary right about now, and even the sequel, which is not nearly as good, but is still quite an enjoyable action romp. Got that. If you're going to make a film about a mummified corpse that comes back to life, it's dumb and it has to be kind of fun. This wanted to take the lore of the original myth seriously without really delving into any of the myth. It's Tom Cruise trying to be Indiana Jones, but Indiana Jones, when they talk about the Ark of the Covenant, when they talk about the Holy Grail, they talk about the lore and understanding and mythos and the writings behind it. Here they just don't. Here they just go straight into the action. And the action is CGI, is heavily dependent on CGI, which is not what we want or are used to with Tom Cruise. So you have a relatively boring, generic action flick, which is based on a property which we've seen adapted since time immemorial. I know Universal wanted to bring out their Dark Universe monsters here and there, but this is like War of the Worlds. The Mummy, original Mummy films, and moreover, The Mummy, is still good. It's still in the cultural zeitgeist. We didn't need a new one right away. There's no place for the film. It didn't need to be made.
Are we talking The Mummy with Brendan Fraser or going back further?
With Brendan Fraser. Right. I really like that movie.
Because technically that is a remake as well. It was Universal's
reboot. After like, what, 50 years?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, enough time had passed.
Yeah, I think really it's like three different movies which don't really have anything to do with each other.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
It's The Mummy.
Indiana Jones. Mission Impossible 5 and 6.
Right. We skipped over Oblivion and Edge of Tomorrow.
Oh, okay. I guess we should cover them.
Oblivion, I really like Oblivion. I like that there were two twists. One which was very obvious, but then that twist masked the second greater twist, which was about being in the Beyond Zone.
Mm.
I like Morgan Freeman in this. It's one of the few comic adaptations Tom Cruise has done. It's a relatively competent sci-fi. I'm looking forward to his space meeting.
Oblivion's not really a comic adaptation. The comic was something that the director Joseph Kosinski had made because he was struggling to get the film off the ground. And so it's easier. This just shows how mad Hollywood's become. It's easier to get it made if it's based off a pre-existing property. So even though the property only existed to get a film that he'd failed to get greenlit made, it's now based on a property, so we can do that. We can do this film now.
I liked the ending. Felt like it was adapted straight from a comic pain. I liked the end.
Kosinski's
how it's basically Wall-E.
Yeah, Kosinski's movies have that kind of look, like this in Tron Legacy, where it's like it's straight out of concept art. He comes from the advertising and design world. You can see it. The visual design in this is great. It's definitely better and more engaging on a plot level than Tron Legacy. I think William Monahan, who wrote The Departed, did the script. Yeah, big improvement.
Edge of Tomorrow.
It's a fun twist on... Yeah, it's a fun twist on Groundhog Day.
What is so clever about this, aside from being a good action flick, which really well utilized Emily Blunt, is that like Tropic Thunder and Goldmember and all the film and Night and Day, this was very much acknowledging Cruise's public persona and realizing if you want to get the best of both worlds, put me in a movie where I can be action driven, but then people who don't like me, you can watch me die over and over and over and over and over again. So you knew what he was doing. Also, one or two films to star Brendan Gleeson and Tom Cruise with Mission Impossible 2.
This film, I think, is also is also notable as being one of the most video game inspired narratives in recent years. I mentioned Groundhog Day, which is the obvious comparison in terms of how it functions as a film. But what separates it from Groundhog Day is that it's an action narrative where it's about, oh, let's try and get further than we got the last time we died, retrace our steps, but make some different decisions. This film didn't do that well at the box office, but has had quite a shelf life. And, you know, it really appeals to the gamer set.
It's notable that it's one of the few Tom Cruise... This has now been the third Tom Cruise film that will be part of a franchise that he's been in.
Apparently.
Die, repeat, and repeat.
It's strange. The film is called Edge of Tomorrow, which is a terrible title. And Live, Die, Repeat was the tagline on the poster. And later on, they realized, I guess, that it was a bad title after it bombed and tried to change the name to Live, Die, Repeat.
And
Live,
Die, Repeat and Repeat is on point.
Yeah, I kind of doubt we'll actually see that film. I think if movies get on the chopping block after the production halt, that's one of the ones that'll go. But I might be surprised.
Another thing, a brief thing I liked about this, I love that the map they show for like a second at the beginning and how the alien forces invaded is basically a map of the front lines of World War II.
Mm.
Nice little touch. Speaking of how good this is, it's in such contrast to War of the Worlds, where this is not going to be an analogous metaphorical narrative. It's an action-driven one. It knows it. It's aware of what level it's working on. So a similar MacGuffin, a similar issue, works the much better effect here as it did in War of the Worlds. So it's similar alien invasion, although the aliens have very different capabilities. Two meta things that are very kind of distracting about this. One is that there are strong similarities for Looper, which came out only a year before, also starring Emily Blunt. And that's a little bit, oh, really? Did they have to be so close together? And another is that Noah Taylor in this plays pretty much the exact same role he plays in Tomb Raider. And I guarantee you, every single person who saw Tomb Raider is going to see this movie because it's that crowd.
Yeah. I do find about this film, the latter stages of it, when it becomes more driven by the plot and supposedly caring about the characters, aren't as effective as when it's just a wacky action comedy where Cruise keeps dying in amusing ways and there's some brutal sci-fi war scenes every 5 minutes.
I love, however, the sequences where he has to convince Emily Blunt that he is coming back to life again and again.
Oh yeah, great.
And he's just made it so quick smart. Like, there's a great bit where he just walks through the machine arm and he just explains, like, all right, let's get going.
Yeah.
It's become so automated. He's done it so many times. There's been so many riffs of Groundhog Day over the years. It's maybe the best one.
Probably.
Yeah. Go see it if you haven't. Edge of Tomorrow. Next up is what? Mission Impossible 5? Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't like this as much as 4. I thought it was a nice thriller. I really liked the opera scene, which was very De Palma-esque.
Very Scorsese-esque, actually. What's the little short he did with Simon Baker?
I'm not sure, actually. I probably haven't seen it.
I like this more than 4, if alone for Ilsa Faust, Rebecca Ferguson's character, the best character in the series who isn't Ethan Hunt.
She was good. She was good. I think I just found this one, you know, it's not as fun as 4. It's not going for the fun of 4. I found it, I feel similarly about all of the recent Mission Impossible films, which is they're all good. They could be a lot better, but there's just a failure to 100% commit on the plot level, mostly.
What 4 had going was, for the first time in the series, that it wasn't about the IMF or an agency being compromised. This goes back to that, but it triples down on it. It was not just an agency or an agent. Now it's an entire organization of agents who have been compromised.
Mm.
And Fallout ups the ante again with the apostles. I don't mind it because it's the logic this universe is working in. I think it works better when it's more of a genre anthology-focused film. I don't like the series as much as it's gone to serialization rather than and being an anthology, but I still enjoy it. It's a beast in and of itself.
Fallout had exceptional action. I think that is the most notable thing. The motorcycle chase is incredible.
The foot chase. The motorcycle chase in Rogue One was good too. But the foot chase in Fallout where he's jumping over buildings. The incredible scene where he climbs up the road.
I mean Rogue Nation.
No, I'm saying Fallout. I'm talking about Fallout.
Oh, no. You just said Rogue One.
Sorry. Rogue One. Sorry. Rogue Nation. Yes.
Yeah.
As it came out at the same time. At the same time. Rogue One. Rogue Nation. The great scene where he's climbing up the helicopter. The amazing spy versus spy stuff in the catacombs under France. Incredible. Gorgeous, action-driven, fun, old-fashioned storytelling. And I think Fallout triple down on that, which is why I like Fallout more than Rogue Nation. I still really enjoy Rogue Nation. I was always a little annoyed at that poor Austrian premiere who got exploded and then no one talks about him for the rest of the movie.
Like, yeah, that didn't matter.
Yeah, I've been to that opera house. If the Austrian, if Kurtz got exploded outside there, it'd be a bigger story. And also, Alec Baldwin's line about Hunt being the literal manifestation of destiny is so stupid. Alec Baldwin-esque. Actually, that's it doesn't worry me about these films. Alec Baldwin, they're action films where you should be serious, but he can't get out of Alec Baldwin comedy mode. He, I don't think he can anymore. He's traditionally an action drama actor, but
he's become so far into his 30-year-old persona.
He's now funny guy all the time.
It worked in number 4.
It worked in number 4. It was a little more... Number 5.
Right. Was he not in 4?
He wasn't in 4. No, it was... Tom Wilkinson was the secretary, and he got killed, and then Renault. A lot of secretaries being killed in these movies. He was like Baldwin's the Mission Impossible. So we talked about The Mummy. We talked about American Made on its release. We caught up to the releases. I didn't like it. It's a non-charismatic role for a person who really requires a charismatic large.
Wasn't defined by his charisma.
Yeah. Barry Seal. Also, the story is much interesting than the film went on. And it gets the very interesting stuff in the third act. It's kind of boring. If you want to know a bit more about Pablo Escobar and get a bit interesting narrative, go watch Narcos, which this was obviously ripping off.
So what's next for Tom Cruise?
Space.
I have to roll my eyes at it, honestly. Like, it could be cool, but the concept of doing a movie in space is cool. And I just see ego in it. Like, I have to be the first actor in space. Do you know what I mean? Like, it could just be, I'm being harsh. It could just be that Tom Cruise, you know, loves space and was like, you know, loves making movies and wants to make a movie up there. In fact, I'm sure it kind of is that, but his career feels like increasing escalation of stunts.
I think what he wants to do is make every other space movie, the Moonrakers of the world, look stupid in comparison.
Of all the space movies to mention Moonraker.
But and Oblivion, in fairness, and Edge of Tomorrow, where does he go into space in that?
No.
No, he doesn't. But the problem is, they've also, if you read all those articles talk about Tom Cruise going into space, have indicated that one camera person will go up with him, which means you can have a lot of static shots of just Tom Cruise and not lots of cutting and chopping, moving around. And you won't be able to have that much camera dynamics because you're in zero gravity and it's one guy. If the camera gets faulty, you got nothing else to work with. So you're all limited. And granted, you may just be filming some scenes in space, maybe pickups later.
I wonder what film this is for. Limitations. Surely there's a film that is kept secret that this is for. And it's not just like, oh, we do a movie in space, we'll figure out the rest later.
Could it be MI7 or MI8? It could be.
I reckon it's Mission Impossible.
That's so awesome.
It has to be. Like, what else would it be? Because it sounds like they're doing this soon, right?
So didn't we actually joke at the time, like, where does he go now from Fallout?
This
could be what he does.
I wouldn't be surprised. I doubt there's another movie out there where they would, you know, send Tom Cruise to space.
I just want to be there for that conversation. It's like, Tom, there's this film we want to send it in space. So I'm going to space. No. I am going to space.
I bet it was more like, what's the next crazy thing we can do? And it would be more like outer space.
We're going to
we film it in space. I want to thrill you. I don't know.
Can you imagine Tom Cruise sitting at home being like, when am I getting in my spacesuit? Hey, Elon Musk, let's make this happen. Come on, dude.
I'm ready for my spacesuit. That was a bad impression.
He probably already has it fitted.
Oh, like, dude, of course.
We know Tom, and he'll do it.
I'm waiting on my spacesuit, Elon. And then you do that grin, that kind of like weirdly smug grin.
What we have to figure with Cruise is it's not just the sheer brazenness of doing these insane stunts. It's the nerve of how he holds up during it. The bit where he walks out onto the glass on the Burj Khalifa, he had to hold his nerve as if he, and most actors would just fall apart or just look nervous, but he had the bravura to pull it off. And a stunt, he's actually probably his most dangerous stunt. We haven't spoken about it in this episode, but in Mission Impossible 2, when the knife comes down to his face, that was real. A stuntman was rigged to shove a knife onto his face where it would stop about just under an inch from his eye.
Wow.
And Tom Cruise, in order to do the stunt, had to remain and not get his stabbed in the face, had to go back and watch it, had to remain motionless but keep his eyes open to get the shot of the knife coming down into his eye. That's a real knife. The glint is real.
Wow. It's so unnecessary.
No, it's not, Chris. No, it's not Captain Australia. It's Tom Cruise. And I just wish that had been more as obvious as him jumping between the buildings of MI6 or him holding onto the side of the plane in Rogue Nation, because he deserves credit for that. But to have the nerve to keep together during things like that, there's no one else who's working on that level in Hollywood who's as famous as Cruise.
I mean, I shouldn't talk about this, but I've seen other people talk about it. And so therefore, that's my excuse to do it. They did it first. No, but it is a valid concern. He might die filming one of these things one day, you know? Like he
was told he wouldn't walk again after fall, walk properly. He was told he had permanent damage to his leg after the stunts and fallout, where you can see it. He smashes his leg against the building and then gets up and limps as he keeps running. But they had to shut down filming for a while, and then he just got back to it.
Brutal.
Yeah, it's a legitimate concern with any stunt work, but he seems to be incredibly well-trained and know what he's doing.
He's made it the focus of his career. Maybe what he's doing in all the time that he's not making more films these days is just lots of crunches, as you said earlier, off camera. And, you know, martial arts, all kinds of stunt training, I imagine. He's probably just always training for the next big Mission Impossible or whatever it ends up being.
Pushing himself in the next Tom Cruise vehicle.
To the danger zone.
The danger zone.
He's
far down the highway to the danger zone.
He is, yeah.
Of course he's making another Maverick movie. Of course he is.
Dude, that's the thing. Top Gun 2? Like, what? I was reading about Top Gun 2 when I first started reading movie rumors when I would have been like 11. and even then, that was ages after Top Gun came out. It was just one of those like, yeah, I guess we should do that one of these days.
But I think that one of the reasons, doesn't he want to actually get on the plane? Like in Fallout, he learned to fly a helicopter in order to do the helicopter stunts. And,
yeah, which is totally unnecessary, but cool.
But it's not necessary because everyone wants to see it. We want to see the stuff. If Tom Cruise is in a movie, I'm going to go see it. Granted, we've talked about a few I haven't seen, but in the time I've been going to cinema, like I've seen
most
everything he's done.
But that was the case before. It was like, oh, let's see Tom Cruise do this crazy skill.
I've always enjoyed his movies. Like, he is. Will we see many movie stars going forward in his vein? We won't.
I don't think so.
No, he'll never do TV.
I had a thought about Fallout. You know, a lot of the
TV's great.
Yeah, a lot of no, but Tom Cruise is such a movie guy. Maybe he'll do TV. You never know what it'll be like in 10 years. But
when he's 66.
Yeah, you never know. But I thought about Fallout when he jumps out of the plane at the beginning. My impression watching it is this is fake. This is all CG. No, it's real. They just ruined the shot by adding a bunch of CG storm clouds. Don't get me wrong. I know that the storm was an essential plot element, but the effect of seeing that big fake CG thing is that it, you know, I read it as, oh, so he's not really skydiving. This is all fake. I'm seeing the cues that this is fake. And so because we're conditioned that way by movies, I just interpret the whole thing as fake. But no, it's a real skydive with fake CG clouds.
It did bother me. I even knew it going in that it was real, but it felt jarring. And
it feels fake, doesn't it? Watching it, you read it as fake, which is a shame.
It's so awesome that a camera person jumped backward in order to get the cruiser shot of Tom Cruise doing the halo jump out as he does his mask back up. So yeah. Tom Cruise, for the shot, had to make sure his mask was tight and then just jump out of the plane.
Yeah, it's great.
A lot of those. Good on him.
But yeah.
I remember there's a similar action sequence at the beginning of, again, Moonraker, where they jumped out of the plane and had camera people just around them for several takes, and this was a similarly staged sequence. It's really good, but Moonraker looks real because it was real and there were no CGI storm clouds. Should have learned from 79, guys.
It's just a strange thing. Like, there's the lack of awareness that if you see something CG, it cues you to thinking the whole thing is fake, because we're so tuned into CG and so used to those moments of like, is it real? It's not real. Is it? No, it's not, because CG's gotten so good now. There's just a psychological effect. Like, when you see a shot with nothing CG in it, you know that it's real the majority of the time. As soon as you put that one fake CG element in it, from the way we're reading it, that may as well be entirely fake. So it's a shame to ruin the shot in that regard. To go to that much effort.
The Halo job at Tomorrow Red Eyes, that was real.
Really? Okay.
I just thought it was real from memory. But it's a lesson that a lot of directors aren't following.
Yeah.
Which is sad. Kind of like the end of Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol with the scene with the cars, which is very clearly not real.
Yeah.
I'm cool to watch Tom Cruise do action stunts, but this was a down note to end on.
Do you think that he'll ever go back to drama?
Yes. I think he's going to get to a point.
He's too old.
Yeah, he's too old. And to his great credit, a lot of people thought that point was a long time ago. It wasn't. He's still doing the stuff. He's going to get to a point and he's going to move back to more very mature drama like he did in some of his earlier years, and it's going to be good.
Hopefully he takes on some more edgy roles. Like, I wouldn't mind him just doing action so much if doing action didn't just mean doing big budget movies, which means doing safe movies in terms of how the hero is going to be portrayed. You know, like, I'd just like to see Cruise playing different sorts of roles. Like Collateral. Collateral is a great action film. Guys,
do fantasy. Cruise is more in the early stages of his career, but he had those eyebrows and that looked like an elf.
Legend.
Like magical, like a bit eerie, which worked for Lestat. And he still, I feel, pull that off. Yeah. Tom Cruise, hey, thanks for making movies and making great movies.
The Cruise missile.
He's very rarely on cruise control. He is, some movies he is, but he's usually just putting in, I think Jack Reacher he was, but usually just putting a lot of effort. So that's Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
The review he does. When it can be released, they had to stop filming MI7 in Venice due to COVID.
Yeah,
that's on.
I'm sure it'll be one of the first productions to resume.
I'm sure. Well, thanks for listening to our Tom Cruise thoughts.
It ended up being way more extensive than we had planned.
Yeah, but there's lots to talk about. He's been around for like you said. Top Gun was 10 years before the first Mission Impossible film. He's been around for a long time.
Yeah.
Doing cool stuff. Thanks, Tom. And let us know what you want us to fight about. So it's not a Tom Cruise movie because we've covered those.
Yeah, drop us a line. Please. We will appreciate it.
Yeah. And let us know what you think otherwise. And yeah, we'll be back. Stay cool. Stay.
We'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out. I'm trying to think of a Tom Cruise. What's a send-off Tom Cruise does? You had me at...
No, that's not even said by Tom Cruise.
No, it's not. You're right. Tom Cruise, you complete us. You complete us.
Oh, man, but that's not true at all.
No, it's not true at all. That's actually really sad if that was true. We do like you, Tom Cruise, but... Just keep making cool movies and we'll be there for them.
I'll be there for you.
You take our breath away.